the OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to OTB AM this morning. It's 7.30. It's Gerry Gilroy here with you until 9.30. I'm broadcasting live from studio, but also with us this morning, as ever, we have Eoin Sheehan. Eoin, just so everybody knows, we're doing our bit for social distancing. You're in an entire building entirely.
My bunker here to stay away from you, keep you safe, really, Gerry. This is all about you this morning.
You weren't feeling well though last week. We weren't supposed to tell anybody that. You got very upset that we told people that. I was blaming other people and our WhatsApp group. It was actually me, Eoin. I told everybody.
Well, why would you do that sort of thing? People can get mild sicknesses as well around this time.
That's the thing. There were a lot of mild sicknesses going around. But look, we're here. We're going to be here every morning as long as we can, anyway. And it looks like we're going to be grand to do that. The reason that we're in separate places is so that if one of us comes down with it, then we don't affect the other one. And we hope to be able to continue to broadcast every morning. So if anybody out there has anything that they want to get in touch with us about, you can text the show. 087-9180-180 is the number for that. And there's actually loads and loads of sports news happening, particularly in the last 24 hours. UEFA met Tom Brady has retired. Sorry, Tom Brady's not retired. He has left the Patriots. I mean, he's going to Florida, the old folks home that is Florida, to play for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. It's effectively a retirement. So there's plenty for us to get our teeth stuck into. In the meantime, how is life for you, Eoin, in the new normal?
It's been okay. It's obviously been unbelievably weird, and you are constantly in a state of, should I be doing this thing, which involves any little thing that you do. So, for example, I'm sure I speak for a lot of people yesterday when it was St. Patrick's Day, people just wanted to get out of the house, just go for a walk, whatever it was. Like, you often wonder, even on a day like yesterday, is a luxury like going for a walk even going to be taken away over the next couple of days? You suspect it might be when you look at cases like Belgium and their increased lockdown procedures yesterday. But I even went out to the sea yesterday, and the places are just packed, car parks are full, people who want to just walk in public areas. Like, you'd imagine this is going to be gone fairly soon, that like we were being advised to look after our mental health, to get out of the house, to get a bit of fresh air. That can only last so long. So it's going to be really into the box sets after that, isn't it? It may even get to Football Manager level. I hope not. I really, really hope not. But it might get to that level at some stage if we're not allowed to leave the house unless for essential things.
As in, you're going to end up just playing Football Manager. Like, what was that? Was that the game you were addicted to that your mum had to like wean you off?
Oh, I'm not sure. Did my mum have to do that? But I
was
certainly
there not a
had.
Game when you were a teenager that you were very addicted to?
Well, Call of Duty 4 was the one, the first Modern Warfare. I think that there is still a bit of PTSD in my household about how I was such a moody child after coming off the Xbox every evening. But even later in life, the Football Manager life I found myself in, I had to wean myself off that as well. That was probably my hardest things. I'm a recovering Football Manager addict, so this is a challenging time for people like me at the moment. But I will do everything in my power to avoid that.
Nathan obviously told the story that when he first started getting out with his wife, he made her break the CD of Football Manager so that he could like probably spend time with her as opposed to with the computer. And now they're happily married and they have three wonderful children, so that worked out quite well.
It's the most romantic story I've ever heard. Like, really, there is nothing that comes close to asking your other half to break your Football Manager CD. Goodbye, Freddie Adu, I presume, was the last word said before their romantic life took off.
Yeah, I also have pictures of him trying to stick it back together with glue and see if it would still work when it was pieced back together, like one of those. One of the things that we are going to do is bring a bit of culture to people's lives. We're going to talk about Better Call Saul. We've been binging that ourselves over the last while. But if anybody else has any other ideas that they'd like for us to get into, you obviously have heroically been sifting through Dream Team. I saw you getting criticism from somebody going, "Oh, that's rubbish. Why are you doing that?" I was like, well, precisely because it's rubbish. That's the joy of watching bad TV at times of massive global international crisis. Being able to retreat to a bunker and watch crap TV is one of those gifts that this generation has that other previous generations didn't have.
I think people have a strong clinging to the nostalgia element of Dream Team. So I've never watched this program before, and I've quickly realized that it's appalling. It's really, really, really bad. And I've now kind of handcuffed myself to this thing by the end of the fact that I've put up a couple of pieces. There will be another article coming this afternoon, I can assure you. So I'm about 25 episodes into season one, but
how
I haven't watched
all 20.
I think there's like 60 something in season one alone. But the great news is that there are tons of episodes missing. So I've just been kind of, I guess I've been watching I've seen about 12 to 15 of the episodes because half of them are basically missing at this point.
Okay.
But you can read the blurbs and catch up pretty quickly. It's like any soap. You can catch up very, very quickly. But insane things happen. Like this, there is like a dramatic love hexagon going on at the moment where you just kind of like wake up and you get into another episode where you've missed two episodes because they're not online and you're like, that person is now getting with that person. How on earth does that happen? The chairman of the football club of Harchester United is a bad, bad man, a terrible, terrible human being. And that is the main thing that I've learned so far from our coronavirus lockdown.
Right. A couple of quick comments for you. Owen was unbelievable at the 2008 Olympics game on the Xbox. Apparently he was in the top 100 in the world. Were you?
Yeah, thank you very much for whoever sent that in. I was, absolutely. So they had this, I think, overall leaderboard.
Global.
Or was this the 2012? Yeah, I can't remember. No, I think it was 2012. I think it was London 2012, actually, that game. I get mixed up between the two.
Were you not working here at that stage?
Not yet, no, not yet. Thankfully, I was still at home in Kerry, still in my kind of almost man cave, whatever the kind of in between boy and man is. And I was exceptionally good at that game. Exceptionally good. The whole process was how quickly could you bash the buttons A and B, and that's how quickly you ran. And I was unbelievably good at that.
Are there any other any other applications of this in real life that this was good training for later on? Like.
Well, bragging right now, obviously. I'm applying it right now. And yeah, if anybody has London 2012 and wants to take on the absolute master, I will destroy you. And it's archery as well, exceptionally good at that. Any of the aquatics. In real life, I'm obviously a terrible swimmer. But in London 2012 on the Xbox 360, I will swim the legs off you.
So anybody who's been paying any attention to us over the last couple of months realises that we were doing Swim for a Mile with Swim Ireland and we were due to do it next month. And obviously, it's off for now. It's indefinitely postponed. But what has also happened over the last while is Andy Lee put up a video, or somebody put up a video of Andy Lee training a couple of his fighters. I think it was Paddy Donovan and I'm not sure.
Jason Quigley,
I think. Jason Quigley was in it. That's right, yeah. Where they're doing this Jolene challenge where Dolly Parton sings Jolene and every time she says the word Jolene, they've got to do a push-up. Now, I think they were doing it from fists, so they were lying doing push-ups on their fists as opposed to on their hands, which makes it even more difficult. I tried it yesterday because I figured that like by the end of this, I'd like to be able to, you know... It's either sit on my couch and eat all of the chocolate that I got for the however long this is going to be, which I've already done, and just calcify into Jabba the Hutt again, or try and somehow stay fit and healthy. And so I'm going to take the Jolene challenge.
Oh.
And I'm going to try and do it. It hasn't started very well. I did it yesterday and I couldn't get through the first verse. And the first verse... is actually even the chorus, the first verse in and the chorus are the same thing, essentially. So this is very tricky.
Well, I see you've... I was, like, thinking of challenges to do over the course of the next weeks, and I was thinking about just taking a drink every time they say the F word in The Wolf of Wall Street or something like that. You've obviously chosen a far more healthy...
You're going to run out of drink. I mean,
I will run out of drink, and I will be not only Jabba the Hutt, I will be an unconscious Jabba the Hutt, and you will never hear from me ever again. It's a good point. I think that's a very relatable thing you just said there. Everybody's kind of stocked up on junk food, and it is all gone at this point. I've certainly demolished my job. I've got a few cream eggs here, but cream eggs are terrible. We all know that. They're literally the worst piece of confectionery ever invented. But I'll probably get to cream egg stage at some point today.
Yeah, it didn't last very long. Didn't last very long. It's like, oh, this is going to see us through two of the big bars of the big proper Dairy Milk Cadbury, which I was like intending to keep for and gone, both gone. And not the small ones and not the medium ones, the big ones, both gone. And and nothing is stopping or slowing that down. So if anybody has any ideas about how to, ration the rations, this is the bit where we absolutely need the spirit of the Blitz and our... parents and grandparents who lived through rationing in the past. This is why, society likes to keep its elders around so that they can tell you stuff. Unless, of course, if you're the British government and you've decided that economically they might be disposable. If you want to get in touch with us this morning, you can text us 087-9180-180. Here's what's coming up. Graham Hunter's going to join us at 8 o'clock. A massive, momentous day in European football. The Euros were cancelled yesterday from 2020 to 2021. It leaves countless questions unanswered, not the least of which is what's going to happen with the Republic of Ireland manager's job if we do qualify. We're going to talk about life in Spain, obviously, with Graeme, just to see how intense that lockdown is. And Joe Brawley is going to join us at 8:15 to find out what the situation is like in the north. Obviously, there's a very different policy being pursued by the British government, the DUP, and Sinn Féin seem to have very different ideas about what to do with the schools in the north. And it's leading to a lot of confusion. So we'll speak with Joe Brawley at around about 8:15. Sports news with Phil coming your way at 8:35. We've spoken with Davy Fitz about what it means for the GAA in hurling. We'll hear from him at around about 8:40. And then a very special edition of The Snap, which is our NFL show. We're going to do two of these this week because there is so much news coming your way. Cian Fahey is going to join us at 8:45. We'll talk about Tom Brady and everything else that's happened, because the NFL obviously has locked down all of its facilities, but they didn't stop free agency. And in a way, that's very good because it gives us something to talk about and to distract us all from the terrible news that we're living with on a day-to-day basis. Anyway, so that's what's coming up on the show this morning. If you want to get in touch with us, at OffTheBallAM is the specific Twitter account for the show. Or, of course, you can just tweet us at OffTheBall and use the hashtag OTBAM and we get that. We're also picking up comments on the YouTube channel as well. And we're live on that now. So let's bring you through the newspapers this morning. OTBAM. I'm going to start with offtheball.com this morning, and the main story there is the fact that Tom Brady has actually left the New England Patriots and is has now subsequently announced that he's joining the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. It's $30 to $35 million a year for a 2-year deal. He immediately inherits a much better receiving core than he had, but this is one of the biggest stories really that you're ever going to have in world sport. A 6-time Super Bowl champion not being able to do a deal with his current team and leaving. And I don't know what you think about this, Owen, but I'm very surprised. I thought that they were just going to roll the deal over and he was going to play out his days and that was it. That was going to be the perfect end to what has been a perfect career.
Yeah. Are you surprised by the location, though? Like, if you're given the information that he's going to leave New England, like, it seems like a decent fit for a number of reasons. Like, I know you made a Freudian slip at the top saying he retired, but like, this is Tom Brady. I think if he's going to retire, he's going to retire. I don't think he's going to Florida to chill out for a couple of years. Like, I think he's looked at this and said, first of all, I've got a much better chance of reaching a Super Bowl if I move from the AFC to the NFC. Second of all, as you mentioned there, a great receiving core. You're going to have Mike Evans at his disposal, one of the best receivers in the league. That surely improves his prospects of having a good season next year as well. And also, like, Tampa are decent. Like, historically, despite the fact that they have a Super Bowl, I think, have they the worst record in the history of the NFL, certainly in terms of shipping big defeats. But right now, they're not the worst. They've had a quarterback last year who threw the ball away quite a bit. And still, what do they have, a 7-9 record? That is not dire by any stretch of the imagination. Like, he's not trying to turn around a team from tanking to Super Bowl. He's going to take a mid-rate team and try and get them into the playoffs. Like, so I think it's a very achievable thing with Tom Brady, a quarterback there. Like, I'm personally looking forward to the whole retirement home derby between the Saints and the Buccaneers next year, because, of course, they're going to be in the NFC South Division together, Drew Brees and Tom Brady. So there's a number of different storylines here. But certainly just looking at it from my perspective, if Tom Brady was going to leave the New England Patriots and stay playing football, the Buccaneers doesn't seem like the worst decision in the world.
Well, it's obviously a very nice part of the world to live in. Then you're there in late summer when it's swampy and the weather is so hot that if you walk outside, even Tom Brady will sweat in it. Like, I think the East Coast thing was important because, as far as I know, the family lives in New York. There was some talk about Boston, but they sold the $20 million house in Boston, and they've got some massive corner building, I think on Fifth Avenue. Somebody will correct us on that. And so it was important for him to be able to jet home and spend time there, as opposed to moving to LA, which was the other option. Apparently the LA Chargers made a big play for him. The thing about the Chargers is that we come up against Patrick Mahomes twice a year, every year, guaranteed, which I thought that actually that would have appealed to Brady. It was like, okay, I'm going to try and get this team. And they also have a brilliant receiving core, as well as some pieces on defense. So I don't know. I think the thing about Tampa, the thing about the Buccaneers last year is that their offensive line, the job of the offensive line is to protect the quarterback from getting hit. They're not great. And so he's going to get hit a lot. He's going to be spending a lot of time throwing the ball away and trying not to get hit, or getting up off the ground having been hit just after the ball was gone, in the style of the English rugby team attacking the opposition out half. So I think for me, the big thing is that an absolute legend of one city who spent 20 years there, who has become synonymous with their success, has decided that there is something better and more important. And it seems because it's he wasn't given enough love. Like, it's kind of like Steven Gerrard leaving for one or two seasons and going to join, I don't know who, like there's, you know, a team that he thinks could have been better than Liverpool, a team on the same level as that Liverpool side, like maybe Chelsea for a couple of years. I don't know.
I don't know. It's a difficult one. Like, I think it's probably a rung below that. It's like Steven Gerrard leaving to join Newcastle or something like that, is it?
So,
like,
yeah, bear in mind that Liverpool team at the end weren't great, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting situation as to Brady and how we view him in independence of someone like Bill Belichick. And do we still have this view that Bill Belichick was the engine behind Brady for a lot of his latter years? Because I think that was certainly the case. Like, he's going to be 43 years old. And I didn't know that about the offensive. Like, if he's got a shaky offensive line in front of him as a 43-year-old man, that is a very, very dangerous situation to be in as an athlete. We're running through some of the other back pages this morning. I've got the Star here. We've got the UK version. No Idea is the headline for the Daily Star. FA chief admits he's totally in the dark over whether the season will ever finish. And Barnett lay off 60 staff. This has been, of course, the big danger with coronavirus calling off football in the UK, that lower league clubs would suffer. And Barnett, the first one there to be suffering big time. And the last hurrah as racing shuts down.
That's the UK Star. Obviously, the Irish Star on the back page is match of delay. UEFA makes Euros call, but the big league still facing fixtures chaos. They're racing to stand still. The Board of Horse Racing Ireland will meet today, and up for discussion will be whether or not they continue to race behind closed doors. Aviva Euros sales pitch: never miss a genuine opportunity. We might get more games in the Euros in a year's time, is the thrust of Paul Lennon's story, because a couple of the stadiums in which there are games scheduled have concerts. So Hampden Park and Parken Stadium in Copenhagen are already committed to hosting concerts during next year's rescheduled finals. And some other cities may rethink it. The Irish Independent, their back page: no Euros guarantee for McCarthy. Current boss and Kenny both keen to lead Ireland for delayed championship. Mick McCarthy is set to enter June's rescheduled Euros playoff without a guarantee he'll get to manage Ireland at the finals if they do qualify. The logic of John Delaney's controversial succession plan, which sees Stephen Kenny replace McCarthy on August the 1st, is under fresh spotlight, with the tournament pushed back to 2021 and the playoffs fixed for this summer. So, on the face of it, this does look like a stereotypical cluster beep. However, let's just tease out the various possibilities here, Owen. They say the games will happen in June, the qualifiers will happen in June, and the following year would be when the tournament happens. Are the qualifiers going to happen in June? I'm not sure. There might be no organised football until September, at which point the qualifiers would probably get kicked back to September. Maybe there will be matches in June. That would be absolutely amazing, because a lot of good stuff would have to happen between now and then. But Ireland have to win those games for this to actually be an issue. They have to win two games back-to-back. I don't remember the last time that we won two big games back-to-back. Certainly two away games back-to-back.
Well, that's the thing. If the games do end up going ahead, at least this summer, and Ireland lose them, then this is not an issue. This is only an issue if we have qualifiers before the start of the 2020-2021 season and Ireland are successful in qualifying for the Euros. So I think it's as simple as that. I think if Ireland lose against Slovakia or beat Slovakia and lose their second qualifier, then Mick McCarthy is out straight away and Stephen Kenny is in. It's simple as that. But if they win and qualify for the Euros, for Euro 2021, I think Mick McCarthy has to be manager. I just think that this is part of the deal. You qualified us for a tournament, you can see the tournament out, and then you're done. Yes, it is a weird deal, and I'm not for 1 second saying it was the correct thing to do at the time, but this is where we're at. So you have to honour this, really. Like, I think it's a really unusual situation for Mick McCarthy to be told, nah, you're not bringing us to the Euros. You got us here, but you're not taking us into the actual tournament.
It's very far away. Like, it's an extra year of a contract that you don't have written down. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you signed a deal for, I know, really, really extenuating circumstances, but from a financial perspective, Mick McCarthy costs way more than Stephen Kenny does. Like, in the world that we're going to be living in come June, will the FAI have the money to pay Mick McCarthy for another year beyond what they were going to pay him? And remember, there was the bonus payment that was supposed to be triggered at the end of his deal, irrespective of what happened anyway. So, like, the finances of this will absolutely end up playing a part, because we all live in a real world.
Like, maybe it does become a renegotiation and Mick McCarthy would be happier to, I guess the only thing he'll have to do is lead us into, well, I suppose the Nations League is going to come up as well, but maybe he will be happy to take a pay cut. Maybe the FAI can say to them, there were numerous things that have happened since we appointed you as Republic of Ireland manager. First of all, financially, this organisation has found itself in a huge amount of trouble. And secondly, the world has found itself in a huge amount of financial trouble as a result of coronavirus. That means, Mick, we cannot pay you the same wage for another year. Would you be happy to take X euros and we will proceed with a lesser figure for it next year? And if so, let's go ahead and do this. We can't pay you what we've already paid you. And then maybe we can reach an agreement, because that is the other hurdle now, the financial thing that will come from keeping Mick McCarthy around for another year. But I think it's right to actually offer him that. Now, he will say, why are you giving me a pay cut after I've just qualified you for the Euros, which does, I guess, seem a bit ridiculous. But as you've already said, these are extraordinary circumstances. This is not normal. It's not been normal for the FAI, and it's not going to be normal for the world after this either. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll move on to...
The back page of the Indo obviously has that D-Day for horse racing as... D-Day as HRI meeting could cancel Irish racing. There's a conference call board meeting for HRI this afternoon. We'll obviously keep a very close eye on that for any information coming through. What have you got for us next, Owen?
Let's have a look at The Guardian and a headline there. Euros move into stoppage time. UEFA shifts summer tournaments to 2021. Governing body aims for end of June finish for all European club competitions. Hails blow, Pakistan T20 league called off after batsman's symptoms. And French farce, problem for Clay King Nadal as Open moves to September.
French farce is a pretty harsh headline from The Guardian, isn't it? I mean, come on.
Not much they could have done about that, to be honest. It's the screw you for being the epicentre of this pandemic, France.
Yeah. Yeah, let's just wait and see how everything... is Wimbledon... let's wait and see. Will they call it English farce when Wimbledon moves a little bit later on in the year? Let's just wait and see. I'm keeping an eye on you, Guardian. Front page of the Irish Times this morning, Gordon Darcy saying, right now, I'd rather be in the Irish system. So this is a picture of Joe Schmidt and Ian Madigan. Mads had the vital coach-player relationship with Joe that he will seek to build with Dan McFarland at Ulster. Really interesting interview with Ian Madigan on Off the Ball the other night with Joe. He was talking about coming back to Ireland. He signed a one-year deal with Ulster, and he'll leave Bristol at the end of the season whenever that happens. So Gordon Darcy says, filling our day the only way we know how, walk both dogs separately, took the kids on scooter adventures separately before making French toast and watching Bambi. That was 8 o'clock to noon sorted. So far, I've resisted torturing the family with a VHS to DVD evolving series charting my career. Chapter 1, early days, March 96, Clongowes versus Newbridge College. I mean, he's laughing about this now, but like, we're going to like Skype into his living room and watch those games with him in a couple of weeks' time. So, Gordon, don't be blowing all your good material just yet. Euro 2020 postponement adds considerably to FAI challenges. This is like certainly one of the most challenged and challenging situations that any sports administration body are ever going to find themselves in. From the shit show that they inherited to the coronavirus pushing back everything, notwithstanding the fact that they had to organise some of the games here and help organise some of the games here. A very difficult job that the FAI have on their plates at the moment. No need for drastic decisions over games, says the IOC. The IOC not really moving as quickly as everybody else is.
No.
Despite the fact that one of their high-ranking officials came down with coronavirus. I mean, what do you do? Do you like put a pin in it now and then things improve in 6 weeks' time? You're like, oh, balls, we could have got that away. Or do you leave it to the very last minute and give yourself the window of opportunity to say it's going to be different, it'll be a slimmed down version, not everybody who was going to make it is actually going to make it, and maybe, I don't know, maybe for the first time the world looks at the Olympic Games and goes, we really need this now.
The only way I could legitimately see this going ahead is if all the various governing bodies for all the different sports for the Olympics actually say, right, we are going to move our qualifying tournaments to Japan the week before the Olympic Games. That is the only way this happens. Like, you can't just say to people, sorry, we didn't actually manage to hold your qualifying whatever bouts, if it's boxing or whatever, or I think, like, obviously a lot of the boxing did go ahead, but say the Irish swim meet, for example, next month, those sort of events that actually can't go ahead now. Yeah. Like, can you not just take your best national qualifier, put them into a de facto qualification tournament right before the Olympic Games starts in Tokyo 2 weeks beforehand and just get on with it that way? That is the only way I see it happening. If that can't happen, you have to kick it back 12 months. Now, people will say, you know, athletes wanted to peak for this moment and this will now be taken away from them. 12 months is a huge time. I'm sure there are athletes who are going to miss out on this summer as a result of injury or anything like that. So it will open doors for other people. That is just the way sport tends to happen. There is a lot of bad luck, a lot of good luck. But I think if you're not going to be able to properly have the qualifying competitions get underway over the next few months, then you have to kick it back till next year, unless you can just make it happen a week before Tokyo. I know that increased costs and it's a logistical nightmare to fly extra athletes over, but it's the fairest way to do it. And you're right, maybe that is what we need at the end of the summer, because maybe come, even if you put, like, maybe come July, the world will be in a better place. But I do feel that this whole thing has been a little bit focused from a Japanese perspective. Like, this is a global event. This is not a Japanese event. Sure, it's getting better in that part of the world, but it's getting a hell of a lot worse over here.
Yeah, and so those two things have got to coalesce. And ultimately, maybe a bunch of athletes don't decide not to go and the IOC goes ahead with it, and that's not necessarily the right decision either, but we'll wait and see. And as for the moment, the IOC obviously holding a watching brief as well. The headline in the Examiner this morning is IOC remains fully committed to delivering Tokyo Games this summer. And then also that story we've been talking about, no appetite to address handover plan until June, that's the FAI's. And Donald Lennon's written a column today, Farrell was prepared to jump from famine to a feast of activity. So look, if there is a feast of activity at any point over the autumn, we'll all be delighted with that. The Irish Sun, their front page headline this morning is Test Drive. GAA joins virus fight. First cars go for Croke Park swab. Leo, it's calm before the storm and 69 new cases found in Ireland.
The Mirror this morning, I've got the UK version here. Isolated is the headline. UEFA fear Premier League are way behind even Italy and may not play again for months. Virus costs Manchester United £1 billion and has pushed Barnet to the brink. And the last post, it's so turf to take as racing off until May. So this is going to be a very interesting thread over the next couple of weeks and months. The difference between Irish sport being ready to get the green light, whenever that may happen, and UK sport getting ready to get the green light.
The London Times free of the back page headline there is Olympics are 90% certain to be delayed and FA expecting to lose 100 million. French Open stirs up storm. A political row is brewing in tennis after the French Open made a unilateral decision to move the tournament back by 4 months without consulting players and other governing bodies. Pardon me. So they've picked dates in September, which clashes with a range of other things, including the Laver Cup. The Laver Cup, not something that everybody's familiar with. It was a makey-uppy tournament that Roger Federer's management agency invented. And so the French Open should obviously take precedence because it's one of the most important and prestigious tournaments. So anyway, France made a decision, didn't tell everybody about it, and apparently that's the French farce that The Guardian were talking about a little bit earlier on. John Hoare's been in touch to say, hey lads, can you share a kind of top 10 OTB interviews from the last 2 or 3 years, running out of stuff to do? Ha ha, he says. Thanks. OTB Gold is a series which we've launched on OTB Sports Radio. We haven't released it separately from OTB Sports Radio, so the only place you could get it up to this point was OTB Sports Radio. But events, dear boy, events. So we are going to start playing those out for you on the radio, on News Talk, and then we're also going to launch our own podcast series called OTB Gold. That podcast series is coming soon for you. That's pretty much us done on the newspapers. I think if we missed anything, we'll come back to it a little bit later. If you want to get in touch this morning, you can drop a comment on the YouTube stream, youtube.com/offtheball. Or, of course, you can always get in touch by WhatsApp, 087-9180-180. We're going to take a quick break, then we're going to go to Barcelona. Graham Hunter is standing by to talk to him about events in European football, what the leagues might be considering doing to try and get this played, and also how life is like in Spain at the moment.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. OTB Gold. The very best of Off the Ball.
Are you crazy?
This is OTB Sports Radio.
This week on OTB Gold.
Rory goes and wins the Grand Slam. Fair play to Rory, he's had a great career, but I still had a great career with three.
Players that aren't in the team in the starting 11, they're the ones you need to rely on through the season now and again. They're the ones, and Alex Ferguson could do it. He could keep a squad of 20, 22, 23 players happy.
So I said, I want to be as great an athlete as I can be, and I can't be that here.
OTB Gold, the very best of Off the Ball. Weekdays from 1 p.m. and 6 p.m.
This is OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app.
OTB AM.
I'm very pleased they've took the decision to move the Euros out a year. I think it just gives everybody breathing space at a really difficult time, an unprecedented time, and one where, you know, the health of our players, of our fans, and everybody in the footballing family of Europe is at stake. So, yeah, I would commend them for doing that. They have aspirations around the build-up to that and how it will all fall into place, i.e. the qualifications. They also have aspirations, as you know, in completing domestic leagues, etc. So it's a big ask, but I think the hard work begins now and the consultation processes start. But, yeah, very, very pleased to get clarity on at least an aspiration of where we need to be at this awful time.
That was Niall Quinn speaking to FAI TV yesterday. The full 5 minutes are available to watch on offtheball.com. There's loads of other stuff in there, particularly about the League of Ireland, which we'll get to a little bit later on. Obviously, talking there about the European Championship, which is now postponed until 2021, which is clearly the right call in the circumstances. Graeme Hunter is with us this morning. Graeme, how are you getting on?
Gentlemen, well, I'm a sort of phlegmatic person who takes stuff like this in his stride. I'm also extremely happy in my own company because I keep myself amused very easily. But turning the page to the serious side, yeah, we're living through times that I never expected to see in my life. And just as you've heard stories about, news stories about a normally vibrant, noisy city, my neighbourhood is definitely one of the noisiest in the Spanish peninsula. Is extremely quiet. The streets are relatively deserted. Things are abnormal. Supermarkets are allowing you in limited numbers to stock up on the basics. So morning, lads. Morning, Ireland. Nice to hear from you. Yeah, doing okay. Currently healthy. But monitoring what is a very, very strange situation here in Spain, and one that I guess it's predictable that Britain and Ireland are heading towards.
How have the Spanish people, the Catalan people, reacted to the lockdown, and just how severe is that lockdown? Because here it's difficult to kind of fully understand just exactly what the implications are from what you're saying, you know, the queues into and out of the supermarkets. Are they stopping people on the streets and asking, why are you out? Or is it that level?
The pictures, I understand it, around Spain, and let's be frank now, we are confined to quarters apart from medical necessities or food, or if you're a dog, if you have a dog and you have to go for what. So I'm not patrolling Spain. I have to report to you about the differences in conditions across Spain from social media and television and radio, just like you have to. But in my neighbourhood, what we know is that chemists are functioning, supermarkets are functioning. There hasn't been in this part of the world mob buying, fighting over food or toilet roll like you see reported everywhere. This neighbourhood I live in is a really working class sort of old port village, fishing village, where albeit that it's been gentrified, tourists have bought places, there are old-fashioned values that still predominate. So I didn't expect this part of the world to be one that was knocked sideways by it or to behave indecently in social terms. There's a hospital nearby. It has continued testing. The things about the supermarket are about social distancing. They allow a set number of people within. They monitor that quite carefully so that you can shop, get your goods, leave without it being mobbed. I think that seems sensible to me. as far as this neighbourhood is concerned, there are cop cars patrolling, but it's different from, say, for example, the really pretty revolting footage you've seen of drunken British tourists down on in Benidorm, for example, being unwilling to be herded out of bars or off the beach. This is a different place. The cops are here to remind you of your obligations. I have spoken to colleagues around Spain, certainly around Catalonia, who say that the cops will stop you and say, look, why are two of you out together? If you're going shopping, you're going to the medic and you're not incapacitated, then it should be one person out at a time. And Spain has not become draconian about what seems to be... Look, it's a measure that I don't think anybody in the UK or Ireland has really been able to contemplate, that army in some provinces around Spain, the army is being used to enforce the lockdown, and not just cops. And I think that you have to accept that within recent times, Spain wasn't a democracy. Certainly within my lifetime, there was a dictator here. There is a hardcore of people who accept that when the nanny state speaks, you listen. That isn't unanimous by any means. There are Spaniards who are like, I'll do what I like. But I think it's my perception that the way in which Spain's state has inflicted this need to confine yourself to quarters has been more broadly accepted than it would be in other countries that I've visited, worked in, lived in around Europe. So at the moment, you can say that it's odd, it's quiet. There have been outbursts of, for example, I can't deny the fact that at 10 o'clock when it started, now it's 8 o'clock every night, when everybody leans out of their windows or gets onto a balcony and applauds loudly and cheers and shouts for the health professionals that are keeping this country not going, but coping in a crisis without worrying too much about their own health and patently exposing themselves to risk. When you hear that and when you see that lightning reaction is echoed all around Spain, again, it's something that I don't think we're used to. I grew up in the 60s and 70s when the country I lived in, Britain, was unified by strikes. And when I was about 10 or 11, there were three-day weeks. There was no power in the house. You had to stockpile food. And I never expected to see that recurring. But it was a time when the country was paralyzed by social movement. Now, I think that over recent decades, that's been eroded and the I want, therefore I must get culture has grown. So to see this unifying of people's expressions of emotion and unity and spirit, that's been quite, that touches you. And I think it feels, you know, a slight antidote to the unusual solitary nature of this confinement, whereby I live in a really, really small place. And therefore, it's an unusual situation. And there'll be a lot of people, either through ill health or difficulties with mental health, who suffer much differently from me and my family. So this is coming to everybody. So there are many countries that are, you know, ahead of Spain in terms of the curve of how much impact there is. But it's odd. But I know that so far, me and mine, we've been very lucky.
Obviously, over the last 18 months, there's been a huge political row between the politicians of Catalonia and the politicians of Madrid. Who is providing the political leadership at the moment? And, like, you know, everybody says, oh, this situation can't be politicized, but it's a very political situation where somebody has to be in charge of what's happening and what the response is.
Initially, Ger, there were... I have to step carefully here because I monitor it, but I wouldn't say I'm particularly articulate or intelligent on that subject. But there were Catalan politicians who immediately said, right, what we do is we cut Catalonia off from the rest of the country. So before Pedro Sanchez, the prime minister based in Madrid, who's the national leader, said on Friday, there's a state of alarm. And then before, I guess, this is Wednesday, so before on Tuesday, Monday into Tuesday, he closed the territorial borders. Airspace is still open, so is egress and ingress from Spain but by sea. Before those things happened, there were Catalan politicians who said, And I, you know, they weren't joking. This is an opportunity. Catalonia must be sealed off from the rest of Spain. Partly because Catalonia is the number two community in Spain, and Spain is the number four country in the world with the largest rise in virus infections. So there were those who were saying because Catalonia's infections were on the rise, they should close the borders to Spain. I thought that was ill-timed. I've certainly seen very little political rhetoric from Catalonia that attempts to take advantage of this situation. And what I can say, because I think it's the other side of your question, Ger, is that whether you believe in this prime minister or not, and I know that there were many critics saying that he'd acted too slowly, which I personally disagree with, there have been a series of measures whereby the government has announced 200,000 million euros, which will be used broadly to support businesses which are struggling, whereby banks are not allowed to foreclose on mortgages that are unpaid by people who can prove that they've been ill. There's a steady stream of financial support for people who are self-employed and what's called in autonomous status here in Spain. Now, these have only been announced, so the trickle-down effect of financial well-being has yet to be proven. And I think in our industry, what we're taught to do is examine that the claims of government are provable, that they work, that they're not bluff. But in this instance, given this country and the abiding nanny state feeling, I do believe that they're men. I do believe that the money is there. I just can't prove that it's happening yet. And also, it's been outlawed for companies to cut off gas or water or electricity for those who have been left unemployed or left unable to work. And beyond that, private hospitals have been ordered that they must open their doors to public, the general public. They've been commandeered. So I wouldn't come on your show and be a cheerleader for the Spanish government. In terms of the things that you'd like to hear, in terms of the things you believe you're paying for when you pay your whatever form of national insurance and tax, when you elect people, some of the things that Spain's government are saying and doing are precisely what you expect. And if I'm being blunt, I think they contrast extremely favorably to the self-interested pig's breakfast that Boris Johnson's government, I know you don't live in Britain, but there'll be Irish watching you who live in Britain, and compared to the pig's breakfast that self-interested git in London has been putting out, I think Spain at the moment compares well.
Yeah.
It's, I presume, in a place like Barcelona, you don't need a moment like this to help crystallise the importance of sport, the importance of football. We've seen news come out yesterday that the Euros are going to be postponed until next year. You mentioned there the comparisons between different states within the continent of Europe. Obviously, this is going to be a tournament that is held amongst different nations around the EU and, of course, in the UK itself as well. How much has it crystallised it, though, for you, Graham, for people around Barcelona, the absence of this very, very important part of people's lives in Barcelona?
Oh, and you're a tolerant man. Therefore, you may allow me to say that I have to go to my own club in Aberdeen. They've been putting up videos for kids to say, here's your homework that you'd be doing to train with the ball that you can't be doing because we've broken up the training ground attendance. And they've had 200,000 views on that. And they've had the deluge of support and interest from people more widely than the club. Now, that you asked me about Barcelona. But for me, that crystallised things that sport can carry on. So from my beautiful club to Sergio Ramos showing videos of him running flat out on one of these sloped running machines where you're actually running uphill all the time, to various videos of, for example, there are a lot of Atleti players. Most clubs are imposing training regimes on their footballers. via exactly the mode of communication we're using right now, what they call here teleconferencing. But most clubs, again, in the Primera, the top division, have sent it for those footballers who didn't already have home gyms. They've sent specific machinery out, or equipment is a better word, sorry, out to the players' homes. And the demand is that the players, as much as they're not running up and down fields or playing, you know, practicing set plays, that they keep themselves in tone mentally and physically, because with the announcements made yesterday, the president of the federation, that's not La Liga, but the president of the federation, Luis Rubiales, an ex-footballer, has said that the league will be finished, that Spain is committed to seeing out La Liga and the other leagues in the pyramid in a way that doesn't take into account who won the winter championship, who's ahead right now. He's steadfastly opposed to that. So the picture that I can report to you is that the clubs are also, as far as I can see, being quite diligent about reporting when they have cases of this virus. So, for example, yesterday, 35% of Valencia's squad and technical staff had all tested positive for the virus. At the moment, nobody's reported that these are grave illnesses or that there's risk. There's at least six cases now reported at Espanyol, the other big club in the city of Barcelona. And I fully expect that there will be more reports as and when those tests are positive, because Valencia, having played at Atalanta, and Valencia having the highest portion of coronavirus reports in La Liga, played several domestic games, having been in Lombardy to play in San Siro in the Europa League. So I can't imagine that we're even on the beginning of the upward curve of reports of those in the football community who have caught the virus. Lorenzo Sanz, who you might remember being the president of Real Madrid in 1999-2000, had been for a few years before, won the European Cup in 1998 and in 2000. He's the one that Florentino Perez's Galactico policy ousted. He's 76 years old now, and it's been reported this morning that he has the virus and that he's also in a grave state, verging on intensive care. So the impact is there for those of us who want to see it. There have been 491 deaths in Spain, with Madrid and Catalonia, and then I think the Basque Country significantly ahead. And that's, for my money, that's a huge amount of social impact on families and communities around Spain already, and we're merely at the beginning. And then if I can reduce it to the personal to finish, crystallizing, you talked about, the impact on me has been gigantic. It's like removing an opiate. It's like people tell you it is for them when they stop smoking. There's a craving. I don't just miss live football, but everything around it, the people, the stories, the movement, the interest, the discussions, the ideas, the creativity it sparks in you when you do the profession that we do. And I know you're keeping going. I know that you talked about releasing classic interviews. You're producing a news service for Off the Ball AM. I have less ability to do that as a solitary, self-employed broadcaster and writer. And the impact's huge, as far as I'm concerned. And also, it's my firm opinion that when we all come back, and boy, I find that really hard to imagine that it's going to be on the schedule, that the authorities have to plan schedules, and I fully approve of that, not a hint of criticism. But given how staggered the impact of the virus is on Europe and the different stages that the countries are at, all that, I can't quite envisage a unifying date when European competitions can start again, because each country is going to be in such a different state. Domestic competitions, perhaps, although, again, I'm a little bit sceptical, and I'd rather that we were clearer on how to cope with this, how to reduce the damage on society. But having said all that, for my taste, the big deal is that football attempts to show solidarity, humour, attempts to continue speaking to the people that miss it. There's very little that sport can do at the moment to solve things, but sport can show resilience, it can show humour, it can show solidarity with the fans. And I really wonder, with an impact like this, which is, you know, we're all coping with as best we can, but when it will change people, it will change fans. There'll be, for football clubs, there'll be fans who aren't there when they come back. That's a brutal fact of life. There'll be people involved in football who personally are in grave financial situations. There'll be, I imagine, that footballers, as they step off this infernal merry-go-round that we've got them on, where they train and play and travel and negotiate such that they can't think and don't spend a lot of time with their families. My opinion is that a lot of footballers, a lot of football people will come back with a value change, or with a, as if a jar of cold water was thrown over them, because this impacts them. We, and I'm certainly, I don't mean off the ball AM, but I think in our industry, we treat footballers as commodities. And I think it's disgusting. And it hit home to me hearing Wayne Rooney in his column with Johnny Northcroft in Sunday Times, talking about the way in which he felt that there'd been a, not only a lack of leadership, but that footballers had been used as guinea pigs. I think that that is really prevalent in the modern industry. And footballers now and their families, when they have almost unprecedented time together without either training, playing, thinking, negotiating, promoting, getting sponsored, or summer holidays where you're like, okay, we get away, we get out of our bubble, we go and enjoy the sun. This is unique time for the vast majority of modern footballers in the elite level. And they'll breathe and they'll stop and they'll spend time with their families. And some might say, bring me back football immediately. But others will say, God, I look back and I don't like the way the things had become. And I think there's a possibility that we see slightly more articulate, slightly more militant footballers when the competitions do actually begin again.
I hope you're right, Graham. Stay well and we'll definitely keep in touch. Thanks a million.
You too, fellas.
It's Graham Hunter giving us some thoughts on what the situation is actually like from Barcelona. A couple of great points there about what happens next and just how difficult it is to reanimate the European competitions, because at what point do you say that it's okay for people to travel between countries again? Like, the notion that we're going to have an end to this season's Champions League seems, you know, wishful thinking at best at the moment, and I can completely understand why you would be wishful thinking and trying to give everybody the sense that this is what's happening. But like, how do you suddenly decide that it's okay for a team from Germany or Spain now to travel to England or vice versa?
Well, yeah, it's impossible. That's why the Euros has been kicked back, I think, because they realise how this is just so unrealistic for this to happen this year. And I think the Olympics should be following the same suit. But I think really, as you say, all UEFA competitions should be following the same suit at the very earliest, at the start of next season, to get these things played. Like, I think there are two ways of looking at this. You can kind of look at what Graham is saying with a little bit of hope as well, because I think we've heard vague projections, and every projection about when life will resume to normality is a vague projection about when these things might go ahead. And of course, Euro has been kicked back to 2021. It might set alarm bells ringing in people thinking we're not going to have any sport till 2021. But really, I think that's actually just at the more severe scale of things because of the staggered recovery time that is going to happen between countries, that maybe within countries we will have sport resume at some point this summer. And I would say that maybe, we just don't know yet, but perhaps we will get that. It will, of course, be confined into single countries, but that is the first step. The final step is the Champions Leagues and finishing that, and the Olympics and the Euros, where different countries come together. So I think you're right. They are the most complicated ones to come along. Just like one other interesting thing that right at the end there, what Graham said, that the unintended result of this, and it'll be a very small thing, but notable all the same, is the voices of footballers perhaps might be a stronger thing after this. Like, how impactful is the Wayne Rooney comments? How many footballers are thinking like that we are the guinea pigs in all that? Will we now see a response from footballers and athletes more willing to speak about political issues? This issue, not overly political just yet, but every issue gets politicised. will we start to see athletes speak out more about world issues and topics off the pitch? Perhaps we will, because there's a lot of people of our own generation who haven't, thankfully, who haven't had a massive crisis to deal with, who haven't had their backs against the walls in their lives off the pitch or in any aspect of life to a serious level. This is the first challenge for people of our generation on this level, and this is where people of a certain age have to come out swinging and have to formulate ideas, because they are forced to think and forced to struggle on with life. So it's going to be a very interesting time for humans in sport over these next few months.
All right, so let's start thinking about what the future of the GAA might look like. And so we've got Joe Brawley with us this morning. Joe, how are you doing?
How
are
you?
So you just caught the end of that there. How are you getting on?
Good. I mean, we're obviously chronically underprepared in the UK and the North in general. And, you know, still no measures have been imposed. There's no testing. There are no testing sensors. People are being told if they feel symptoms just to stay at home. And so the GAA has been very, very important for us up here. You know, there's been zero leadership from, as you would expect, from Stormont, where everything is sectarian. You know, I mean, in the North, for example, regardless of the ins and outs of any incident, the Fenians support Palestine and the Protestants support Israel. You know, the Fenians support Glasgow Celtic and the Protestants support Glasgow Rangers without question. And, you know, if we're going to get an Irish Language Act, then they have to invent an Ulster Scots language to give an Ulster Scots Act to the Protestants. And it's been no different with this. You know, it's you know, the Fenians are saying that we need to go to lockdown and follow the WHO. And the Prods are saying, oh, no, look, this is all very over the top. And so, really, we've been very reliant on our lead to see what's happening in other countries, and particularly the GAA up here. So the GAA community has gone into lockdown up here in accordance with best practice, but I fear it's too little too late.
We've a piece with Paddy Talley on offtheball.com this morning. He's a senior lecturer in physical education at St Mary's College in Belfast, and yeah, he's been talking about the whole notion of what Johnson was saying was, oh, look, you know, keep social distancing. We're going to cocoon the old people around, but the schools and education, keep going, lads, because...
Well, I mean, it's... I suppose the natural human thing is, you know, look, until you see it around you, until you see the bodies going to the morgue, that, you know, look, it might be okay. And that's a natural, you know, human instinct, because... You know, you need, in something like this, you need the government to lead. I mean, I've not seen a single person with a mask. No masks have been issued. No gloves have been issued. People are self-conscious about that here. So, you know, you go to the airports, you see the Chinese people and the Japanese, you know, and they're like Homer Simpson in the nuclear factory, and we giggle at them. They're not self-conscious about dealing with these things because it's government-led, and they've moved extraordinarily quickly in Hong Kong, Japan, the 31 other Chinese provinces, you know, that weren't taken by surprise. You can excuse Wuhan because they were taken by surprise. But elsewhere, you know, Taiwan, Singapore, they've got on top of this, and they've got a mortality rate of less than 0.1% because they've gone into immediate lockdown, social isolation, they've closed the schools. All the measures that have been shown to be best practice. Like, we've got a, you know, and I say this sincerely, I know people say this as a cliche, but I say this sincerely. We've got a buffoon as Prime Minister in the UK. You know, a fella who, I mean, I don't know if you've ever tried to read any of his books. No. You know, he's offhand, contemptuous, not particularly bright, doesn't believe in anything, and was a perfect vessel for a spin doctoring machine. I mean, he was the perfect vessel for the last election campaign in the UK, which was remarkable for the systematic lying that occurred during it and the absence of any detail, you know, a simple message, you know, let's get Brexit done. And whenever it was clear that it was coming for us with a vengeance, coronavirus, the initial response of the UK government was to say, look, you know, carry on, ignoring all the best scientific advice from around the world, ignoring the evidence of countries that were already dealing with this. And so nothing was done apart from this word that was used to say, oh, well, look, we'll reach herd immunity and that will deal with it. Just to be clear for your listeners, herd immunity is a fact that occurs after an epidemic. It's not a policy, you know. And so what happened then was Imperial College were about to leak their research. They were about to leak their advice, and then the government then had to U-turn the day before yesterday. That advice saying, look, that if they continue with their current policy, hundreds of thousands of lives in the UK would be lost. But even once the U-turn took place and they said, OK, look, you better start staying at home, and all they did was give advice. No measures have been imposed. And, of course, that means that that gets them off the hook for compensating businesses, things like that. So you look at a mature democracy like Denmark, where they have very strong public services, a history of 40 years of progressive taxation, logical politics. They have just announced about a week ago that they would pay 75% of all employees' wages, therefore taking the pressure off employers, you know, and allowing people to concentrate on what's important here, which is to protect our vulnerable and elderly people. Because we see now in Italy, yesterday on the news in Channel 4, they had quite shocking footage of hearses queued up at an incinerator facility, and just body after body being taken out of the hearses, put into the incinerator. No mourners allowed. The public health system there is completely overwhelmed. They have a mortality rate of about 7.5%. They've been losing, on average, 350 people a day for the last 7 days. And what I'm being told here in the north, and what UK doctors are saying, I mean, there have been a number of public contributions by them over the last 5-6 days. We're 2 weeks behind Italy here. So, you know, in the north, it's just, you can't believe it. Like, pubs are still open here. Restaurants are still open here. I mean, Belfast, apart from people themselves deciding to isolate, Belfast's open for business. And, I mean, it's clearly a coronavirus issue here.
Joe, it's interesting that you mentioned Boris Johnson and the buffoonery that has existed post-Brexit. Like, I think it was Michael Gove at the time who said, we've had enough of listening to experts. That sort of attitude seems to have prevailed right into this current crisis as well.
Yeah, well, I suppose there's a contemptuous aspect to these guys, you know, riding through the peasants, you know, and whipping them. It's like a Walter Macken novel. And, you know, it's all, you know, there's no logic with it. I mean, I noted that Professor Michael Hannage, who's head of, he's the head of the epidemiology School of Public Health at Harvard. And he wrote a piece in The Guardian where he said that when he initially saw the UK government's response to the coronavirus, he thought that it was satire. You know, he thought that this had actually been put together as a satire. And he just said, look, you know, they're going to lose hundreds of thousands of lives. And notwithstanding that this was, you know, opposed to science. And then, of course, what it does here is it has caused panic here in the north, because people are saying, look, there's nowhere for us to be tested. And I come back to the point, which is, that this shows the great community value of the GAA, that the GAA very quickly followed the WHO advice and sent out to every club, every county, we need to lock down here. We need to close our pitches. No training, no gatherings, no meetings. Close your social clubs, no matches. And that, you see, you've got to understand this. You wouldn't appreciate this from the south. In the north, who do we take our lead from? So we looked to World News, we looked to the GAA particularly, and so that was very helpful for us. It gave us great confidence to do the things that the otherwise would have been quite self-conscious about. So what you see in GAA communities in the north now, so for example in Dungiven, my hometown, it's lockdown. All the elderly people, all our vulnerable people, people who are sick, people who have had a transplant, things like that, they're having groceries left at the door. grandchildren are coming and tapping the window two or three times a day, and the elderly folk are tapping the window. We're making sure everybody's looked about. I don't know if you saw, you know, if you look at social media and you see all the GAA clubs in the north talking about delivering groceries, here's a number to ring if you're alone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're doing all that ourselves. And you see the West Belfast clubs, the West Belfast schools have closed down, even though schools in general haven't closed down. The schools in the GAA areas are closing down. And so you see something that I've been evangelizing about for 30 years. Look, you know, the games are only a small part of what the GAA does. What we really are, our great strength is our, as a community organization, as a social and political force. And the point that I've been making continuously is that instead of being obsessed with elitism and, you know, just a few teams every year and basically All-Ireland semi-finals and All-Ireland finals and getting the big sponsorship deals and doing all that, all of that's fine. All of that's fine. But what we need to concentrate on is increasing our political and social and community power. And instead of just saying, look, we're great at funerals. We're great whenever a child died in the community. You know, we're great at rallying around when one of our own loses their job, you know, because they've had a serious accident. You know, we're great whenever there's a crisis like this. We should be entrenched in that. You know, that should be our key purpose in life. Community, community, community. You know, for the sake of community and for the sake of prosperity, pulling together. And you know, it's so obvious to me when you see what's happening in the north here. And I mean this sincerely. We look to the GAA for our leadership at times like this. And I've got to say, you know, they've not let us down here. And
I do think also the image of the car driving into Croke Park and the fact that Croke Park was so publicly made the first testing centre in the country is actually very important. It's like, okay, for anybody who was uncertain.
So, yeah. You know, when you see that that's something that we've built ourselves, it's debt-free, you know, it's hard not to feel great pride in that. And the trick for the GAA hierarchy is to think about how to get us back to a situation where we all feel ownership of that. You know, because increasingly we feel like consumers. And it's very, very, very important that we start looking, you know, obviously this has to be done in a modern way. There's absolutely nothing wrong with us earning a lot of money and making sure, you know, that we're able to fund everything that we need to fund. There's nothing wrong with that at all. Let me make it clear. But the point that I'm making is that you're absolutely right. Like the pride that you feel when you see that, you know, it almost takes you by surprise. You know, but you understand that's something that we need to be working on. Let me put it to you this way: we should be in a situation in the GAA where, you know, unless someone has the right sort of community altruistic message, they simply couldn't be elected in politics. You know, we could dominate the political scene. You understand? We could be saying, look, okay, well, look, you know, that's not our politics. That's not helpful to this community. I don't see how that helps the prosperity of this community. I don't see that that's a good message in this community. So this is a candidate that we will not vote for. You understand me? Like in Ireland, in the north, the Ulster GAA have effectively a full-time lobbyist in Stormont who's been responsible for bringing in literally hundreds of millions to GAA clubs. There's not a GAA club in the north now that isn't state-of-the-art with pitches, 4G, floodlights, all the rest. In the south, there's not a single GAA lobbyist in the Dáil. Not a single one. So even basic things like that, things that we should be looking towards in the future, social, political, community capital, and building on that.
We're obviously, we haven't this, I mean, as Varadkar pointed out last night, the storm hasn't hit, but it's coming.
Well, I mean, I just thought that was a shameless PR exercise. I mean, I thought he was going to make some type of announcement about sealing off the border, you know, to emphasise. I mean, surely there must be huge concern in the south about the complete inactivity in the north. I mean, a friend of mine in the Royal Victoria Hospital, a consultant, you know, some of the early yesterday morning said, can you curse in this programme?
You can.
I'll just tell you what she said. She said, so this is going to be fucking Armageddon. We are not ready for this. Because what happens in a health service where the proper isolation measures haven't been taken? So the countries that have got out ahead of this, you know, Singapore, Japan, the 31 Chinese provinces, you know, Taiwan, South Korea, what they've done is they've immediately gone to lockdown. Immediately gone to lockdown. They've done what Dr. Mike Ryan and the WHO has been saying for 2 months. Get out ahead of this. Speed's the important thing. Don't worry about making a mistake. Be draconian. You know, more is good. And they've done all of that. So their health services are coping. The problem that you see in Italy and in Spain and in France is that their health services aren't coping because they didn't get out ahead of this. And so all of a sudden, you've got 400 people, you know, for 100 ventilators. And now you're deciding who dies and who lives. The doctors are getting sick. I mean, in the north and in the UK, doctors aren't even being tested. So there are a lot of them going around with the virus. Many of them are having to go home. You know, and whenever this hits, as everybody's braced imminently for, I mean, privately what's happening in the hospitals here in Belfast is, because obviously I have a very good line into the transplant community, the organ donation thing, all of those sorts of things. But privately what's happening is that all the doctors are retraining, getting ready for intensive care. And once this hits, they are all saying that we're going to be overwhelmed. This is going to be a catastrophe. And, you know, very quickly when that happens, then you really get proper panic, you know. And it's just, you cannot believe that Diane Dodds, for example, who's the Minister for the Economy, is coming on the TV at night and saying that they're following the advice of the Chief Medical Officer. This is the same Chief Medical Officer who was advising that nothing needed to be done because of herd immunity. And only whenever Imperial College London's research team, who are advising the government, were going to leak their paper that said that this is going to lead to hundreds of thousands of deaths, was that policy U-turned. And yet, on TV the night before last day, Ann Dodds, who's the economy minister, was saying, well, you know, we're not going to close the schools. We're following the chief medical officer's advice. We're not going to impose a closure on pubs and restaurants, etc. And I mean, people are just, you know, so you've got this, again, as I say to you, everything in the north is sectarian. It's obviously pathetic and very difficult for people in the south to understand. But we're left with this nonsense, you know, and in the north, we're saying, who represents us? You know, who represents us? Who's going to lead for us? So it's very, very worrying indeed. And the only consolation is that in the GA communities, we have gone to lockdown ourselves. We've imposed it on ourselves.
Obviously, lockdown only works if everybody's doing it. Social distancing only works if everybody's doing it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and you see that, you know, children are obviously the main infection carriers. They're very tactile, naturally. You know, they're huggers. They're all that sort of thing. And, you know, like we have a big constituency, as you have in the south, of patients on dialysis, you know, whose immune systems are extremely low and they need to be kept away, kept in isolation. You know, many of them have children. You know, these children are going to schools. And so in the north, what's happening again is that people are saying, OK, I'm not going to send my kid to school. Now, that puts pressure on because, there's, you know, the individual then has to make a decision himself or herself. What's happened in the countries that have got ahead of this is they've announced packages. They've said to parents, OK, don't worry. There's going to be a three-month moratorium on your mortgage and your rent payments. So they've done that in France. They've done that in all the countries that have got out ahead of this. You know, big stimulus packages for business coming from the state. I mean, let's look at this. We bailed out the banks. We bailed out the banks to multiples of the amount of money that's going to be required here for individuals. It's time now to start bailing out the citizens. You know, I mean, the citizens of Ireland, let's look at the Irish situation, for example. The Irish government can borrow money at virtually zero, 0.1%. They can borrow it at. Borrow it, give a stimulus to the people, make sure that you take it out of the people's hands. You know, that's what they've done in the countries that have got ahead of this. I think there's going to be a lot. There's going to be a lot of financial misery.
Yeah, and that brings an anxiety. That's the other thing that I just wanted to talk about. Like one of the conversations is people are anxious, and they're anxious for two reasons. They're anxious about their loved ones getting a disease that we don't know enough about to be able to say with any certainty that like they're going to survive. Because we're all concerned about our parents and our families and exactly what impact this could have on our communities. That's the first thing. Second thing is everybody's worried about their jobs. Everybody is literally worried about what's going to happen next because spending has stopped. And very quickly, the government needs to come out and say, we've got this.
I think there are two things about this. First of all, we see from the Scandinavian countries the benefit of a mature society where they've got progressive taxation. They're not being raped by multinationals who are simply coming in and using it as a tax haven. You know, they've found a balance. Don't get me wrong, capitalism has been the greatest vehicle for change. You know, it has freed people from slavery effectively over the last 100 years. But the problem is that we have not controlled it. It's completely uncontrolled now in societies like ours. And so we're at its whim. But in the countries that are going to survive this and are going to, you know, get through this, so, for example, the Scandinavian countries where they've got huge wealth funds, you know, they have got progressive taxation. They insist that everybody pays their fair share. You know, they're going to come through this. And they've got very strong social security nets so that now the people who might be inclined to follow the Daily Mail nonsense of, you know, oh, they're dole scroungers, well, they won't be saying that now. They won't be saying that in 2 months' time when they're at home, hardworking people, you know, who are not able to work, saying, my God, what am I going to get, €150 a week? How are we going to survive? How are we going to pay a mortgage? How are we going to pay rent? This is why we need a strong safety net in society. This is precisely why we need that. It's okay for someone like me. I've been very fortunate. You know, I can decide to stay at home. I don't have to work. You know, I can relax from that perspective, you know? But the vast majority of people can't do that, you know. And so this is where we see the problems with running on the edge, the way a place like the United Kingdom, a place like Ireland has been working over the last 20 years. No council houses, you know, steady reduction in taxation benefiting, you know, the corporations and the elites, you know. An extremely complex tax code that was effectively written by vested interests. So it's all very well to yaboo about this in normal times, but we're going to see the reality of it now. And so in a place like Ireland, what we're left with is that the government must borrow big now to support people, just do what they did during the bailout, just borrow big. Central banks everywhere are, the IMF, the ECB, they're all going to loosen the strings now because they realise, you know, that this is the only way to do it.
Yeah.
So Ireland are just going to have to do what they did. This time we're not bailing out vested interests. We're going to have to bail out the people. And it's a pity that we have to go to these extremes, which they don't have to do in other mature democracies where they've got things right in general. You know, and maybe this will be a harsh lesson for us all. And I have to say, I thought it was particularly nauseous last night, Leo Varadkar taking a PR opportunity in the middle of this to come out and say absolutely nothing. You know, I mean, talking about the mammies and the daddies and all the children doing their homework, you know, and all this coy stuff that's obviously been written by some speech writer who's decided this is a good opportunity for Leo to look prime ministerial. You know, wasting everybody's time for 10 minutes of soundbiting. And, you know, I have to say I was enraged watching this on the television.
Let me just play devil's advocate for a minute, right?
People were tuning in thinking that there was going to be some sort of a message, you know. And I mean, Churchill, the oil bigot that he was, must have been turning in his grave when he heard him referring to his great speech. I mean, Leo's a guy whose instinct is to do nothing. I mean, he's been dragged along. He's been dragged along by the WHO and best scientific advice and all of that. In Ireland, nothing was done whenever it should have been done. You know, they sat on their hands, allowed travel, kept the schools open, kept all the businesses open. You know, it was very, 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 very light touch. You know, And then the cheek of him to come on and take a PR opportunity like that, I was very, very, very disappointed.
Well, isn't
the time for politicking, you know?
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Okay, and I
what did he say? What did he tell me? One thing that he said that was new.
Tell me one thing
that was an announcement.
The only thing that sounded like any kind of announcement was that they're building contingency plans for the Leaving Cert. It was very small. But I just want to say briefly, right, so my WhatsApp groups and my social media was full of people praising him for showing leadership, right?
Of course they were, but it wasn't leadership at all. I'll tell you what we're like. We're a very sentimental nation, and we love a wee shaggy dog up a tree story. Like, whenever I give a kidney to somebody, which was a basic human thing to do, all of a sudden I was lionized and became a hero in Irish society, which was way out of whack. You know, and it's easy, like, you know, nobody's better at playing on that old sentimental stuff than me. You know, and, you know, I mean, I could see Leo coming a mile away with that stuff. I thought it was extremely disappointing. You know, this isn't...
Do people not need a little bit of that?
This isn't the time for that sort of nonsense.
But do
you
people...
know, trying to position himself, cash in politically, because that's all it is. Leo's instinct has always been to do nothing. I presented Leo 3 times... Brought our experts down from the north, showed them best practice on transplants or organ donation, how to save countless lives. Here's how it's done. It'll save the state a fortune. There it is, start to finish. Involved all the experts. You know, we had 10 consultants in the south who went to see the previous health minister. We carried on that work. We handed him a blueprint. Here's how to do it. 3 times, nothing was done as health minister. Because his instinct, and I know what people like you were like, his instinct is to do nothing. He's done nothing since he was the Taoiseach. Let the market dictate. You know, and he does the PR spin thing. And, you know, that's a typical thing now. We see it with Boris Johnson. We see it with Donald Trump. PR and spin is sufficient to sustain you, because people succumb for that sort of nonsense that we saw last night.
Yeah,
this isn't the time for that.
But let me just read you some of the comments that are coming through. John Austin Byrne, I thought Varadkar was good last night. He's talking nonsense about Leo last night. Most people I know were glad for the address. It helped to instill much needed calm. There's 2 things that have to happen at the moment. A sense of calm is important if that's what people thought, that's fine.
But I thought it was threadbare. I didn't think that he said a single thing, and I thought the purpose for it was spin. Different if he was coming on to make a serious announcement, a change of tack. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what you need to be aware of. Here's what's going to happen.
Yeah, right. I guess
none of that was happening, you know, and I just thought it was...
They're going to make the case that they've already put a lot of those things in place. It did feel like we were heading into lockdown. I think that was certainly the early in the day when it became clear that there was going to be an announcement. A lot of us were like, OK, we need to make the plans now for what a lockdown society looks like.
We thought he was going to announce that he was seeing off the border, which would have been a strong signal to the north to get its finger out. Now, that would have been useful. To say, look, we're going to seal off the border as of from tomorrow. So we thought that something like that might happen, but
would you like to see that happen?
And again, like, I mean, I cannot believe, you know, and it was just typical Leo. Like, he meets with the Northern Executive. And instead of eating the arse off them and saying, look, this is not acceptable. We're living in one island, you know. Do you not understand that nothing is happening in the north? There are no measures being taken at all. Nothing has been imposed. You can do what you like. I mean, the local pub next door to me is going flat out last night. It was packed.
Yeah.
Packed.
Yeah.
You know.
It's terrible.
And all that's like, fine. I said, oh, no, it's, and then the soundings that came out of that meeting, the city, you going apoplectic. The soundings coming out of that meeting were, oh, you know, we're very close, we're not far apart. And Arlene Foster's able to stand up and say with a straight face, you know, look, the differences here are just timing differences.
Yeah, look,
I think it's insulting to people's intelligence, and I thought Leo's address was insulting to people's intelligence.
So you want more...
I mean, we've got... It's a wee bit like Boris Johnson saying 2 days ago, the UK... is now leading the global fight on coronavirus. That's what he said. And Leo wanted to appear to be at the vanguard of the global fight against coronavirus, you know, hitting a noble tone and all that nonsense. Get on with your work. Do your job. That's what he should be doing.
obviously he's going to argue that he is doing his job, right? That's
well, of course, you know. Well, that's fine.
Look, and
let's see what happens whenever it hits us.
That's the thing. Like the notion that the Italy game was called off, but then all of the Italian tourists were allowed to fly in. That just didn't seem to make any sense. Like we're not going to put them on the stadium together, but we're going to let them wander around Temple Bar.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's another thing that all the countries that are ahead of us have done. They've locked down travel. They've just locked it down. They've locked down their own borders. I hope that somehow, we will not end up in an Italian-Spanish type situation. And, you know, with 19 test centres up and running now in Dublin, I think certainly over the next 48 hours, my information is that they'll all be up and running. But that's going to make a huge difference because two of the most important constituents scientifically from reading all the science from around the world are the mass testing and the contact tracing. But again, let me say this to you, there's not a single testing centre in the north. So there's neither testing nor contact tracing in the north.
Yeah, now look...
If I were you guys, I'd be shutting the border. Lock it down.
What they will say is that they have put in a massive amount of contact tracing in the south.
But none in the north. I'm saying to you, there's none in the north.
I know, but I'm just going back to the point that what the HSE have done is they've, as far as I know, they've emptied beds in hospitals ready for the surge. For when it comes, they've talked to the private hospitals to make sure that those beds are going to be made available. They have trained and retrained thousands of people for contact tracing who weren't doing any of that stuff.
Let me be clear about this. The Free State's getting into the groove now. It's getting into the right groove and you're doing the right things. You know, I mean, I know that because I had a conference call the day before yesterday with some of our epidemiologists, intensive care doctors, transplant, right? And the Free State's getting into the groove. But the point I'm making to you is that, all right, it's late, but it's happening now, and it's crucial. Anything that slows this down is going to be crucial because then your health system doesn't become overwhelmed. Then your death rate stays down. What's happening in Italy is their health service is overwhelmed. People are dying because they're not getting access to ventilators. They're not getting access to proper treatment. So you're doing the right things. We're not doing any of them here.
Look, it seems stupid and unimportant to talk about getting games back on. But at some point, we are going to want the distraction of a local match that we're allowed to go and watch.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, I mean, you're right. Of course you're right. I mean, you know, you only fully realise the impact of TA in your life. And I mean, I know that there are sports nuts who'll be listening. And of course, whatever sport, I'm not, you know, trivialising other sports, you know. But... you only realise the importance when it's gone. I mean, we're in cold turkey here because our lives revolve around, you know, I'm in court and I'm on telly and doing all that stuff, but my real life revolves around the pitch. That's where it revolves around. And it revolves around the training, the underage, doing the youth work in the club, the social gatherings that we have, you know, a few pints after the games, all of that. Like in the last 2 weeks alone, we've lost our school's cup final. We had 8 kids from our minor team playing in the school's cup final here. That's been put off. It was supposed to be played yesterday. You know, we've missed a match. We've missed 2 training sessions now for the minors. And, you know, without any live sport to watch, either, you're saying, like, oh, Jesus, you know. So, I mean, there are only so many times you can watch Maradona's great goal against England at the World Cup without Karen off it.
Yeah, YouTube's pretty good. We might do a classic games club where we look back on the 93 All-Ireland final and get some of the protagonists involved to look back on it.
Or the 94 first round, which Michael O'Mahony always said was the greatest game he'd ever seen, where we lost gloriously to a last-minute goal from Down.
That's a good shout. The glorious sunshine to remind us all about what the sun on our backs might feel like.
To remind the younger listeners that Derry used to have a football team.
I think a cessation of hostilities on that front for the next 6 weeks at least might be.
My Tyrone friends are texting me to say it'll be the longest Derry have stayed in the championship for 20 years. Dirty low Tyrone dogs. But I will say I do come back to the central message that I have that, you know, the TA has shown serious leadership here, you know, and. you know, I have I mean, I'm extremely passionate about the community side of the GAs, you know, but really they played a blinder for us, and what we've done in the North is rather than dither, the GA communities have gone to lockdown, the elderly in lockdown, the sick in lockdown, and we're following best practice, you know, just through that the solidarity of the GA community. So hopefully that will make some impact on this and help to preserve life.
Joe, we'll leave it there. Thanks a million for joining us and stay safe.
No problem, boys. Keep doing what you're doing.
It's Joe Brawley there giving us his thoughts on the situation and the differences between what's happening in the North versus what's happening in the South. And obviously what's happening in the North is being led by British government policy. And I don't know if everybody was paying attention over the last 48 hours. It's hard, obviously, to pay attention to so much information coming your way. But the British government, the Financial Times reported that their modelling had been based on viral pneumonia as opposed to COVID-19. So the assumptions on which their original science had been based were based off an entirely different disease than the virus that is actually currently ripping through Europe, which is now the global epicentre of the COVID-19 crisis. So that was the bit where, I don't know, you've probably all seen Paul Coggan's brilliant video and from Virgin Media, where he was talking about the 250,000 people dying potentially in the UK. That was obviously a very low estimate based on the mortality rate that was nowhere near the mortality rate that they had in Italy. And since then, the British government have said that, the data changed and so our policy has changed. But the data didn't change. The data never changed. And it's interesting to see that the UK media are just, again, taking what Boris Johnson says largely at face value, which I personally can't believe. I really don't understand how there isn't more uproar from people in Britain who have relatives who are going to be significantly impacted by this. And I think, Owen, you made a great point about Michael Gove saying people are tired of experts. Well, this is what happens to your society when you don't listen to experts.
Yeah, definitely. Just, it's interesting what Joe was saying there about Leo. Like, part of me agrees with what he's saying, that what was said last night, there wasn't much new in it. Of course there wasn't. It wasn't an information broadcast. But I think it's unfair to suggest that it was spin. Like, what exactly was Varadkar spinning last night? I don't think he was trying to spin anything. I don't think he was trying to put an angle on it, a Fine Gael angle or anything like that on it. I think it was information, concise information, and the whole point of it was to calm people down. Now, if you need to calm people down using cliche and using information that's already out there, then I don't care. That's fair enough. That's totally fine. I don't think everybody is as up to speed on the tone and the attitude we should have towards this thing as someone like Joe Brawley is. There are people watching that broadcast last night who perhaps aren't as familiar with some of the phrases or some of the habits that Varadkar was trying to encourage. I thought it served a very good purpose. I don't think the purpose was to deliver any new information or to put a political spin on it. I think it was to encourage calm. And I think he did deliver that quite well. But he's entitled to his view, Joe. And I think that view has definitely been out there, that there wasn't new info put out there last night.
Yeah, like, certainly the details of an economic stimulus, the line about fear is a virus or whatever was the specific, I mean, that is 100% correct. One of the things that counteracts that is really high-end information saying, don't worry, you're not going to be evicted. Don't worry, you don't have to pay your electricity bill if you lose your job. Don't worry, you don't have to pay your gas bill if you lose your job. Don't worry, you're not going to have to pay your property tax this year if you lose your job. Some of those specifics would have been great. Or, look, we're actually working in the background on a very specific economic stimulus plan. We will reveal that in 3 days' time or early next week. We'll go through the specific details of that. That would have been very welcome, I think, because people are genuinely worried about what their futures are when it comes to what job they're going to have, if there's going to be a job for them, what small town Ireland is going to look like when the pub closes and can't reopen, when the one restaurant in town or the one cafe in town closes and can't reopen because the landlords have decided that, well, look, I need to get paid my rent because the banks are asking me for mortgage repayments. So that, I think, would definitely have helped last night. I know a lot of people were very impressed in the moment, and that's great. But when we all woke up this morning, you know, the day after Paddy's Day, when the hangover kicks in and the drink wears off, and you're like, what did he say last night? What, like, so this morning when you woke up, you're like, oh, that was great last night, I feel good about it. What are you left with? You're thinking, yeah, that was, that point made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, but that's a fair point. It's true when you actually delve down into, as I say, the new information, there wasn't a lot there. Personally, I thought when once it finished, it was like, okay, this is like the starter. Get ready for another one of these broadcasts in a couple of days when we go into full lockdown, almost getting the country into the habit of listening to these things. Perhaps that's the situation.
Exactly. Look, that's the psychological impact here. There's a war on two fronts. There's a war on telling people to wash their bloody hands and stop talking to each other from right beside each other and to stay away from each other. Don't go out. Don't go to the pubs. Don't have a house party. I saw people carrying cans around the streets yesterday who were clearly all going en masse to a house party, and you want to wind the window down and go, what the hell are you doing? Anyway, that's one side of it. The other aspect of it is the psychological well-being of the nation, and maybe getting everybody to the point where they're calling for lockdown is actually more important than going straight into lockdown, because everybody goes, oh, why are we doing this? As opposed to getting the country... Now, it's a high-wire act, because if it's too late and the health service gets overwhelmed, then you were much better being the asshole who locked down the country in advance. It's like, it's definitely difficult. It's not a situation where they have a handbook for, except obviously the situation that Joe mentioned in Singapore and Hong Kong and all those countries, who all failed at this, by the way. In 2003, when SARS and the outbreak there happened, all those countries were completely found not to be capable of dealing with the situation because they had no handbook for it. Look, we'll come back to this, and there's been a big response to that. So I know some people are unhappy with the fact that Joe said what he said, but like, none of the stuff that he was saying seems factually inaccurate. And I think that it's important that people in the South realise just how unprepared the North is and how far behind even the latecomers to the party here in the South and our policies, no matter how late they are, they're way ahead of where we are in the North. And we share this island. That's the most important thing here. We share this island, and that's why the policies of Boris Johnson matter so much to us as a society. If you want to get in touch with us, you can text us here. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number, or you can also use Twitter at Off the Ball, or you can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. We'll get to them in a couple of minutes' time. Now, our next guest is Conan Byrne. Conan is in the midst of a marathon walk today across Dublin to every League of Ireland stadium in Dublin to raise money for the Irish Cancer Society. Conan, why are you doing this? What's going on?
How's it going, lads? Well, I know Irish Cancer Society have missed out on their major fundraiser this year, the last little day toward, at the end of the month. So just want to do something very, very small to contribute to a wonderful charity like that.
Yeah, so when did you get the idea to do this?
I'm sitting on my couch on Friday evening. Obviously, I'm a teacher as well as being a footballer, and both out of not doing any work at the moment. So I just wanted to give something back. I don't have any healthcare criteria, I didn't do study healthcare or anything like that, so I can't help out in that field. But so if I could do something else rather than just sitting down, and so I just thought of doing this. I fundraised before, so it's just, this has just taken legs in the last couple of days.
So where are you starting and where are you walking to, Conan?
Well, I'm actually in the middle of the Phoenix Park right now. So I started at Talca Park this morning, made my way up to Dalymount Park, and I'm on my way now to Richmond Park, so the home of St. Pat. So I am walking through the park at the moment.
Is it literally, are you doing 26 miles? Is it a full marathon, or does it take that much to get into all of the grounds?
Yeah, funnily enough, I was only going to just do the stadium. When I did the map out, it measured exactly the 42 kilometres that a marathon should be, 26 miles. So, yeah, that's it's just funny the way that they all make up the marathon.
At Conan Byrne CB7 is your Twitter handle. But if anybody wants to donate, and obviously these are difficult times, but if they can donate to the Irish Cancer Society, you know, this is a very at-risk group. When the coronavirus hits, it is definitely going to be people with compromised immune systems who are most at risk and who will most need the medical care that our health service can provide. So if anybody does want to, in any way, get involved or donate, how do they do that, Conan?
Well, you can go onto my Twitter handle, as you said there, Conan Byrne CB7, or even just text cancer to 50300. It costs €4 for that. So either one, it will be great.
All right. Well, Conan, we wish you the very best of luck with it today. What's the weather like at the moment?
It's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Yeah, it's a bit cold, but look, I'm walking the whole time, so it's not too bad.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, we wish you the very best of luck. It's a great initiative. Congratulations on it. And I hope you raise an absolute fortune.
Cheers, I appreciate the support.
We're going to let Conan go. We're going to let Owen go in a moment and we'll get to the snap. I want to just read some of these comments here. We've got Conan's audio there in the background. That we'll kill that in a second. Lads, we have groups of teenagers all over the place, and groups of 40. A shutdown is needed. They don't understand at all. I don't know if you saw plenty of people around, Owen.
In terms of people wandering the streets with cans, like you said yesterday?
Yeah.
No, not on that level, to be honest. I think people are out, people are about, they're keeping their distance and trying their best to do so. But you just get the feeling that even the small luxury of the moment of being able to be independent and walk around, even if it's by the seaside and everybody is well spread out, you kind of get the sense that the days are numbered on those sort of enjoyable experiences. So no, I haven't, thankfully, not seen too many people with big slabs of cans under their arms doing something that they shouldn't, because like it was almost jarring to see Chief Medical Officer actually saying to clamp down on specifically COVID house parties. But I think it was necessary. I think it was something that needed to be said. I think if anything has been proved over the last couple of days and weeks, it's that the Irish people need to be told what to do, and they tend to follow it, in fairness.
The UK and its Prime Minister giving priority to the economy over people's lives. History won't be kind to them, says Graham Farrell. Graham Morgan has a different view of Brawley. Not very bright. He went to Oxford, says Graham Morgan. I mean, look, just the fact that he went to Oxford doesn't necessarily make him very bright. Not very popular. Recently won the UK general election with a landslide. Left-wing idiot, says Graham Morgan. Graham Farrell says, brilliant stuff from Joe, as per. You could hear a pin drop here with Brawley in this forum, says Adam Lacey. And then the backlash. I thought Farrakhan was very good last night. He's talking nonsense about Leo last night. Most people I know were glad for the address. Helped to instill much-needed calm. One announcement was this could go on for a really long time. I thought Leo was very good. Joe's anger at the lack of action in the north can't be aimed back at Leo, says Sean McCarthy. Leo's doing a way better job than Boris, says who's that? John Austin Byrne.
I think that's like kind of a false equivalence. Is it trying to compare Boris Johnson or Donald Trump to Leo Varadkar? I think there's definitely a part of this that is making us look very good. Because to the east, we've got people who aren't handling this very well. And to the west, we've got people who aren't handling this very well. That being said, if you take us as a standalone case study, I fully believe that the way this government has reacted, people would say it might be a couple of days late, but at least it was days, not weeks. And I think everything they've done since last week's lockdown has been exceptional, actually. And I thought last night's address was good, even though it didn't tell us anything new. But I do think that, you know, you look at the UK and it is making us look good, but still, I think credit has to go to us on a standalone basis.
Yeah, look, there's the French talked repeatedly about this being a war, and now Johnson has started to adopt that language. And like, ultimately, it's hard not to agree with that type of language, that this is the most serious thing that, as you've said, our generation are ever going to face. And, you know, hopefully this is the only pandemic that we do face. But if you're thinking in those terms, then you actually need to fight it with whatever tools you have. And propaganda to keep morale up is actually going to be very important. Now, we might know that we're in the middle of some propaganda. That's okay. Like, it's, you know, it's like the... it's like you take advice and you take comfort from whatever you can take advice and comfort from, and that calms things down a little bit. And then a few days later, you come out and you go, okay, well, now we're going into lockdown. And everybody goes, yeah, okay, that's a good idea. It's like, it's absolutely. He did also talk about cocooning last night, which was the next strand of what's going to happen. And like, you know, there's heartbreaking photographs of grandparents looking at their kids or grandkids through windows. And like, this is a very difficult thing that we're all facing into over the next while. And, you know, what the psychic scarring is done to families who are going to be broken by this. So anyway, we're going to continue talking about sport, more sport than we did today. Obviously, we're kind of still in the midst of the news coming through, and the new normal hasn't fully seeped in just yet. So I don't know if there's anything else you want to talk about, Owen, before we wrap up with you.
No, like, that's it. Basically, would echo kind of that. I think it's anybody who's just joining us now, I'd encourage them to go back and actually listen to what Joe has said. And I guess the kind of big contradiction in it all, and it's probably a necessary one, is he talks about the great GEA community spirit that's probably existed. And at the same time, we should probably be closing the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Where is that GEA community spirit if that border is closed? But I completely accept that that's probably a necessary step, that if people want to actually make that legitimate case, considering how the UK have handled this.
Yeah, and you know what? It might actually, it's interesting that it might be the GEA community in the north who are saying that, and who knows what that leads to in the future. Like, this, everything is up for grabs right now when it comes to the future of our island as an island. The last thing I want to say is that a brilliant idea for Classic Games Club, the 1994 Ulster Football Championship first round.
Yeah.
I mean, were you born? I'm not sure.
Oh, I'd say I was about to be born. I'd say my mother was heavily pregnant when the Ulster Championship threw in 1994. She's never mentioned it somehow, but I'm sure she was. It would be amazing. Let's do it. Let's go. Let's troll some through some YouTube to find some games that are up.
Well, specifically that one, because as far as I know, a first round match in the Ulster Football Championship had never, up to that point, been televised live. But you had the defending champions in Derry, and you had the Down team that everybody knew was this absolutely sensational team, who had obviously had the backbone of a team who'd already won the All-Ireland, going up against each other. And for once, glorious, absolutely glorious sunshine, wherever the game was played. For some reason, I have it in my head it was Newry, but it couldn't have been. Surely it was Clonus. Maybe not. We will do that in the Classic Games Club.
The full highlights are up online. If somebody has the full game, get in touch. If somebody has it on VCR or something like that and has a digital version, even better, get in touch with us.
All right. Oh, and we're going to let you go, and we're going to talk to Cian Fahey next with a special episode of The Snap, given that American football decided that they were going to continue their free agency and the start of their league season, which has been an absolutely massive story and a bit of a boon for those of us who don't want to just endlessly scroll through the Twitter bad news of coronavirus. So we're a coronavirus-free zone mostly for the next 25 minutes or so, with The Snap coming next.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
Off the ball.
Salah takes a shot. Oh, Mo Salah with one of the goals of the season. 25 yards out.
If you throw your lot in and play senior international football with somebody, that should be the end of it.
That's brilliant. Oh, my goodness me. You will not see a better try.
Who will be All-Ireland champions? Who will see their dreams turn into reality? Whose names will be etched in history forever?
OTB Live. Never miss the action right here. Every Saturday and Sunday on Off the Ball. OTB AM.
Right, you're very welcome back. You're very welcome back this morning. It is time for us to turn our attention to American football. And we're talking on The Snap this week with Cian Fahey. We also have Ronan Mullen with us. Cian, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Good morning, Jar. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm we are all waking up to the news that Tom Brady is a Tampa Bay Buccaneer. There's going to be a pirate ship at the end of the stadium that he looks at every week when he's playing. What's going on?
Yeah, well, like, this has been anticipated for a long time, but it's one of those things you anticipate and then don't expect to actually happen and be real when it comes down to it, which is what I said last week on the podcast, which I've kind of made myself look foolish and undercut myself a little bit, because I've been saying for a while that the Buccaneers make a lot of sense, but then at the last moment they just felt like he'd go back to the Patriots. And apparently, like, we've heard about acrimony behind the scenes, problems behind the scenes for the last year. We've never got any real specific details. But over the last 24 hours, we've heard that Brady threatened to walk out of a practice before the start of was the 19th season, where he had over a dispute about money. He did not actually get a firm offer from the Patriots in this negotiation. So it's very much a case of the Patriots saying, hey, we don't really want you. You may want to leave as well, but we don't really want you back. So there's a lot more that's going to come out of this. But for the moment, we have Tom Brady moving from the AFC, the Patriots, one of the teams that everyone cares about in the worldwide, everyone knows about. Tom Brady himself is a brand that everyone knows about, to a Tampa Bay Buccaneers team that is largely irrelevant. Like, it has a lot of talent, but as a brand, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are in Tampa Bay. The only people who care about Tampa Bay Buccaneers are in Tampa Bay, so they're not even the biggest team in Florida.
Well, it just struck me that this might be very good news for Manchester United fans when it comes to trying to sign a global superstar. The Glazers are going to go, hey, hang on a second, what if we were to add some, like, top quality world class talent to the football team that we owe as well?
I would call that the optimistic look. I think the Glazers might look at this and say, we're spending $30 million on Tom Brady. We're moving up towards hitting our minimum spend in the NFL that we have to spend now. The price of what we spend has just gone up, so maybe Bruno Fernandes is the only big player you get at Man United for the foreseeable future.
Right. Here, look, the Brady thing, the team that he's actually going to, right? It made sense in some aspects. It certainly made sense from he wanted to be on the East Coast. I actually thought that going to LA made far more sense. He's recently set up a production company. They do have loads of really good pieces. They're a few pieces short, but they, you know, their receiving core is just as good, maybe not quite just as good, but very good. And their defense has some brilliant parts to it, like you know, Bosa and Derwin James. You kind of think, okay, being the face of a franchise in Los Angeles, the size of that market, you know, suddenly he has base on both coasts. It's like, wow, that's where Tom Brady becomes this mega corporation over the next 10 years. Now he's gone to Tampa Bay. It's like a really quite small town. It's a bit off Broadway. Why do you think he'd pick this one?
Well, the football reasons make more sense. I think there are reasons that the Los Angeles Chargers would have been a better option. Keenan Allen is a perfect type of receiver for Tom Brady. Well, actually, he's a perfect type of receiver for Tom Brady in his prime. I'm not sure he's a perfect type of receiver for Tom Brady now. Keenan Allen is like a much better version of Julian Edelman, where he can get open underneath all the time whenever he wants. He can get open on intermediate routes. No coverage can actually contain him, so he's always going to create a window for you to throw into. In Tampa Bay, you've got Mike Evans, who doesn't really create much separation, but he's 6'6", and he can catch anything that's thrown anywhere close to him. You've also got Chris Godwin, who does the same thing. And then you've got OJ Howard, who is an Aaron Hernandez-style tight end, which Tom Brady's worked with before. Cameron Brate would be a Rob Gronkowski type of tight end, not as good as Rob Gronkowski, obviously. But stylistically, those players make a lot of sense. So the same problems existed in both places where the offensive lines weren't great. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers have a run-blocking offensive line, really. You've got Donovan Smith there at left tackle. The Chargers just traded for Trey Turner from the Carolina Panthers. They gave up Russell Okung, who rarely played for them. They just signed Brian Bulaga as well, I think. Brian Bulaga has had three ACL tears, is constantly injured, a former Green Bay Packer. He's going to a team that has the worst medical staff maybe in all of sports because all their players constantly get injured. Surpass the actual football fit. I would suggest the way that Brady has talked over recent years about him wanting to maximize his football income, the money he's earning in salary. Being in Florida, you're not getting taxed. Being in California, you're getting pretty heavily taxed. The costs of living in Tampa Bay, like, I know this doesn't apply necessarily to someone like Brady, but it does apply if you're not actually going to stay in that place permanently. The NFL season is very short, so Brady probably is going to rent a place in Tampa Bay, which will be dirt cheap relative to renting a place in LA and living in LA. So there are financial upsides to being in Tampa Bay opposed to being in LA. And with the way the world is, like, he can run his production company from anywhere. He's going to end up living in New York, end up living in LA the way he has his places currently. Being in Boston was always kind of this thing as well. It was a contentious issue because his wife doesn't necessarily want to be there. But he was in Boston for 20 years. He became a global superstar. He can do it from Tampa Bay as well.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Ronan Mullins with us this morning. Ronan, how are you?
All good, Jer. How are things?
Any clever puns for us on Tom Brady? I hope you've been working them. Like, the one thing that we all need in this time, right now, in the time of coronavirus, is some good puns from Ronan Mullins.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was totally correct, Jer, but I'll give you my hot take on this. I do think that TB12, it's more of a TB12 Inc. decision than a Tom Brady football decision. And we know he's a winner and he always wants to win, but this is very much about brand building. He put that number of age 45, he wants to play till he's 45. I think that's what this is all about. He knew there was no long-termism in New England. Like, Bill Belichick put that on the table a couple of years ago. So he's, like you're mentioning, his options, but I think this was almost, he had to take whatever was coming, and Tampa Bay is a good fit for him in the end, I think.
So it seemed like he was pushing for San Francisco, and that wasn't actually realistically an option. But the Raiders in Vegas would have been pretty cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and there's an absence of a superstardom in Tampa Bay, as we said there. Los Angeles, I think we called pretty early, was a pretty obvious one. Like, it fit both parties. Like, it's an easy exposure for him and also exposure for them. They need to sell those seats because they're renting a stadium off the Rams. If you ask anyone what team plays in Los Angeles, they probably wouldn't even be able to name the Rams, let alone the Chargers. So I think that would have been an obvious fit. The Colts have gone down the Philip Rivers line, which we would probably get to. But I think Tampa Bay would probably be asking themselves, is Tom Brady the right fit for us? Because they were sort of an all-singing, all-dancing offense last year. James Winston had his 30-for-30 season, 30 picks and 30 touchdowns. But can Tom Brady really do those kind of down-the-field passes that Winston was trying last year? I'm not sure. I'm sure he can adapt.
Yeah.
But I know Bruce Arians was comically undermining Winston last year, saying, if we had a quarterback, we'd be a playoff team. And
now he's got one.
They have a quarterback now, yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting point, Keane. What's your take on this, like the down-the-field throws that Brady isn't able to do? Here's the point. If you've got Mike Evans, you don't need him to separate. You feck it up there, and he comes down with it.
Yes, and Brady's lack of velocity is less of an issue when you have someone like Mike Evans, because if the ball hangs up a little bit, he's the one who's likely to win it rather than the defensive back. On this, I have a Twitter account called QB Data Mine right now, which is QB Data Mine, all one word, obviously. And it's just simply tweeting out the charting I do and putting out the results I do. And Tom Brady and Jameis Winston this week were obviously two focal points. So the biggest difference between Tom Brady and Jameis Winston is that Brady is 10% worse on intermediate throws. On deep throws, they're actually the same. And when you consider who they were throwing to last year, Brady is probably a better deep passer, even with his declining velocity. Like, the thing about Jameis is Jameis has no idea how to play quarterback, and he's a bit of a complete disaster, really. So he had 30 interceptions last year. He had 21 more dropped. He could have had 50 interceptions last season, which means he wouldn't have been on the field, because if those passes had been caught, Bruce Arians would have benched him. And Arians basically came out and said, we can't win with this quarterback after the offseason. So you knew he wasn't coming back. For all of the highlight plays and all the big plays, like, that's not really how you win games. That's not really how they win games. They were on the precipice of the playoffs last year, but Winston was the primary reason they didn't make the playoffs. Does Brady give them a chance to go to the Super Bowl? Probably not. I don't think they're going to be a contender in the NFC. There are better teams in the NFC. Like, take the Seattle Seahawks as an example. They're probably not the best team in the NFC. They'd be better than the Buccaneers next year. The positive is that Brady is a lot smarter. The question mark for me, less than downfield throws, is how he's going to fit behind the offensive line. So the benefit here is you've got to have a spread out offense where you get all those four weapons on the field all at the same time, which isn't something Tampa Bay has always done. And it's not something Bruce Arians likes to do. But you've got to get all your weapons on the field at the same time, the same way Josh McDaniels and the Patriots did, the same way Bill O'Brien and the Patriots did, same way the Patriots have done all through Brady's career, and give Brady the opportunity to get the ball out instantly. Because if he has that on quicker, shorter throws, you can change that offense, you can make that offense work. Because Mike Evans, while he's a massive guy, is also a rare talent in that he can run any route at any level. He can get open. He has very quick pitch fibers where he can make the quick movement as well as the long stride downfield. So if you change the offense up like that, it should work. And when Bruce Arians worked with Carson Palmer, and as much as Bruce Arians wants to work to a specific offense and drop deep in the pocket and throw the ball 30 and 40 yards downfield all the time, when Bruce Arians was in Arizona with Carson Palmer, that was the style of offense he ran. But he also went to Carson Palmer every week and said, give me your favorite 15 plays and we're going to focus on them. And that's how a good coach works. So Bruce Arians goes to Tom Brady and says, give me your favorite 15 plays, let's focus on them.
Yeah.
Those aren't going to be those deep shots. Those are going to be the shorter, quicker plays that they're going to cut teams to death with over and over and over again.
There's loads of other stories that we'll get to a little bit later on in the week in terms of the second wave of the Jadeveon Clowney's, where Cam Newton's going to end up on. But the other big breaking news over the last 24, 36 hours or so has been the absolute theft of DeAndre Hopkins. For regular watchers, Bill O'Brien was the Penn State coach. We went over and watched him coach. He was very nice. He was very accommodating to us. I've followed his career since then, and mostly I've kind of been able to understand what he's been trying to do. But this is madness. DeAndre Hopkins is one of the best players in the league, and he has been given away for a handful of magic beans.
Yeah, I think the best... Let's stick with the Man United references here. If you took Odie Ighalo and you had Manchester United and you went to PSG and you said, can we have Kylian Mbappe? We'll give you Odie Ighalo. That's basically what just happened. The Arizona Cardinals gave David Johnson and a second-round pick to the Texans for DeAndre Hopkins and a fourth-round pick, I believe. So basically, they've dropped down 60 places in the draft and got one of the best wide receivers in the league, maybe the best wide receiver in the league. It's an inexplicable move, but it's the type of move that Bill O'Brien has been making. He's now the head coach and the GM of the team. And this is something we've talked about previously. You need to have two different minds there, because the head coach is more emotional. The head coach is more irrational. He's someone who believes he can win whatever roster he has, and he thinks anyone is dispensed or can be dispensed with. And GM has to sit there and go, hey, DeAndre Hopkins is irreplaceable. We can't replace this guy. He's a little bit expensive, whatever you want to say. He's a key piece of all of our success. And last year, when the Texans were 24-0 up in the playoff game against the Chiefs, the problem wasn't DeAndre Hopkins, it was Bill O'Brien. So Bill O'Brien is hurting the Texans in season, hurting the Texans in the offseason. And this is actually a fascinating thing, because the Cardinals have had a good offseason. They've added Jordan Phillips as well to the defensive line. They've made some very good moves so far. And DeAndre Hopkins comes in there now with Kyler Murray, who is an incredible deep passer, he's actually a more accurate overall quarterback than Deshaun Watson. He obviously has to grow a little bit more than Watson because he's at an earlier stage of his career. But you add DeAndre Hopkins there, you're getting a guy who is basically Larry Fitzgerald in his prime. I would argue he's better than what Larry Fitzgerald was. Oof. And Larry Fitzgerald is the Hall of Famer. So, like, Larry Fitzgerald is still there, but now Larry Fitzgerald gets to just be the slot receiver all the time while Hopkins plays outside the numbers all the time. And that spread offense is going to be outstanding. And they've got Kenyon Drake in the backfield there anyway, assuming they re-sign him. So they have no concerns about losing David Johnson. They've swapped out an $11 million salary for David Johnson for a $12 million for DeAndre Hopkins. That's crazy. Stephon Diggs went immediately after and got so much more in reward. Stephon Diggs is one of the best receivers in the league, but he's nowhere close to DeAndre Hopkins.
Yeah, it's such a weird comparison. Go on, Ronan, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, like, the minimum, surely, we saw with Amari Cooper when he went from the Raiders to Dallas, that the cost should be a minimum number one draft choice. Like, for a first tier receiver, you need a first round draft choice because that's the equivalent. I know this is a very stacked wide receiver class and there's going to be people available second, third, fourth round, but there's just no reason for the Texans, who were actively shopping him, which I find utterly bizarre. It would have been different if someone dropped this on them and they weighed up their options and said, right, let's pull the trigger on this. But they were looking to get rid of this guy, talking about friction in the camp. But like friction, Tom Brady and Belichick, by all accounts, have had friction for 15 years and they've still won multiple championships. So you have to park that stuff. And Diggs, we've mentioned there, he's never made a Pro Bowl in five seasons. Hopkins has been first team All-Pro in the last three seasons. So this is the caliber of talent we're talking about. Is he the best receiver? He's definitely one of them. And I just find it baffling.
Brandon Cooks got a first round two successive seasons in a row, and we're getting literally a handful of magic beans. I'm saying it again. If you look back at what the Rams paid for Jalen Ramsey, who is an elite level similar to DeAndre Hopkins in a matching position, it was two first round picks and a second round, I think.
Hayden Hurst this weekend, Jared, Hayden Hurst, who people will remember infamously picked ahead of Lamar Jackson by the Ravens in that draft, has been traded to the Falcons for basically the same draft capital.
I think more. It's a third and a fifth, more. Wasn't it? Because you're not taking back David Johnson, who's washed.
Yeah, well, second and the fourth, third and the fifth, we could argue the toss on that, but you're right, yeah, it's basically slightly more.
Is David Johnson washed, Keane?
He's on the way to be. He's very unfortunate. He's had a couple of bad injuries. Maybe you can say that it's actually just the life of a running back because it's happened to Todd Gurley. It happens to pretty much everyone. The Hopkins trade is layered in a different way in the sense that he has been previously outspoken about wanting to leave Houston. But that was when Bob McNair was still there. And Bob McNair is the owner who referred to his players as inmates running the asylum when they were in, I think it was in the lockout year in negotiations. Or it might have been, actually, sorry, it was when Kaepernick kneeled.
Yeah.
So obviously he got in a lot of trouble for that. And Hopkins was one of the people who was outspoken about that. Dwayne Brown is someone they traded away, one of the best left tackles in the league. He's been great in Seattle. He did not want to be there anymore because of the culture in Houston and because of McNair. And they spent two first-round picks to replace him with Laramie Tunsil last year, which is another awful trade because as good as Tunsil is, it's a crazy amount of capital to give up for a player, an individual left tackle. So the thing about that is this was surprising because McNair is now dead and Hopkins hasn't publicly said anything about wanting to leave. There was a little bit of speculation about 3 hours before the trade actually happened, but it wasn't even strong then. It was, hey, DeAndre Hopkins, some teams believe he might be available. So obviously that actually had fire to it, that smoke that kind of comes around all the time that you hear and you ignore. But the other aspect of this then is Hopkins afterwards had no sadness about this. He was immediately on Instagram Live showing that he was trading. He was celebrating the trade immediately afterwards. It didn't feel like he was blindsided. But Deshaun Watson has talked about him and talked about how he doesn't know how he's going to replace him. And he seems to be in shock. He didn't seem to know it was coming. Players across the league have looked at this and said, this is insane. Cameron Hayward of the Pittsburgh Steelers said GMs should be drug tested, which kind of seems like a fair comment at this point when it comes to Bill O'Brien. But the on-field impact for the Texans is going to go surpass just losing a number one receiver, because Deshaun Watson is now going to be under a huge amount of pressure because they don't have a high-quality receiving core.
Oh, Randall Cobb. Poor Randall Cobb. Look at you casting aspersions on a guy who, again, was washed up 3 years ago.
Yeah, well, they have Kenny Stills, who's very good, and they have Will Fuller, who's very good when healthy. But Will Fuller can probably play 10 games a season with the way his knees are. He doesn't always play, and that's been a big issue for them. And that's what's changed their offense, because when they've had two receivers running downfield and kept everyone else in pass protection and executed hard play fakes, Deshaun Watson's been incredibly good. But now they can't do that anymore because they don't have a receiver like Hopkins who's going to get open no matter what. So it completely changes the identity of the team, completely changes the offense. And the AFC South, like, between them, the Jaguars and the Colts, this looks like a division that's setting up for the Titans to run away with it fairly easily next year, which is a weird thing because over the last few years, that's always been a division where they've all been mediocre and everyone's been stuck together.
You mentioned the Colts. We should talk about them. Philip Rivers has it's been widely predicted for months that once he was done with the Chargers, that it would be the Colts because he's got best mates up there. Is he not washed up? Is there any chance that he can make that work?
He's very washed up. Philip Rivers is 38 years of age, going on 39 during the season. And he's replacing Jacoby Brissett for $25 million for a one-year deal. But he's replacing a quarterback who's more accurate than him, which is something people are finding hard to believe just because of their perceptions. Philip Rivers' arm has died. He worked with Frank Reich 5 years ago. Frank Reich was under Ken Whisenhunt from 2013 to 2015. He was the quarterback's coach. Then he was the offensive coordinator, so he worked directly with Philip Rivers. I think the Colts and Frank Reich in particular are failing here by looking at Philip Rivers and thinking that's the guy who he was in 2013, 2015. But since 2015, his arm has dropped off dramatically. He has become a guy who struggles to throw the ball 15 yards on the field, struggles to throw the ball 20 yards on the field. If it's a vertical route, the ball is going to float and hang in the air. He didn't get away with that the last couple of years, but the Chargers have been able to offset it somehow with Mike Williams, who's been incredible. Mike Williams, Hunter Henry, exceptionally good. I talked about Keaton Allen previously. But these guys have been able to cover a lot for Philip Rivers' errors. So now you move him to Indianapolis, where they've traded their first-round pick for DeForest Buckner, so they're not going to get one of these top-tier receivers that's available in the first round. And now they've got T.Y. Hilton, a very small receiver who needs precise passes, even though he's good at getting open downfield. Rivers is going to struggle to hit him. You've got Zach Pascal, who is just ineffective and not capable of being a second option on an offense. You've got Chester Rogers still there. You've got a bunch of different receivers who aren't capable or aren't good enough to be where they are in the offense. And you've got Paris Campbell, who was taken ahead of Terry McLaurin last year, who's clearly been a mistake because Campbell was nowhere near what McLaurin was as a rookie. McLaurin was a superstar. Campbell just looks like he's a little bit of speed, and that's it.
He was injured, though, wasn't he? Ebron. Campbell was injured for a good bit of the season, so not. Not totally got on him. Look, sorry, I just want to go back to Stefon Diggs because we did mention there was a bounty of picks that Stefon Diggs managed to generate for the Vikings, and yet he is also good enough to be able to transform an offense. Like there was a lot of people rushing to judgment on this that the Bills ended up getting fleeced here, but I'm not sure that's true.
I don't think it got fleeced. I think a first-round pick, which is essentially what it is, because the rest of them are fourth, fifth, sixth extra picks that don't really matter. A first-round pick for Stefon Diggs is good value, but the problem for the Bills is they're not going to maximize his value. He's going to be wide open all the time, and Josh Allen is so inaccurate. He misses wide receivers constantly. He was the worst deep passer in the league last year, and it just doesn't fit their identity. As a team, they need to focus on running the ball and building up their same identity they had from last year. Adding Stefon Diggs for a first-round pick, I don't think is going to dramatically change their offense, like you said. But Diggs is also so unfortunate. He did not want to be in Minnesota. He did not want to play with Kirk Cousins anymore. He's gone from an indoor stadium in a cold city to an outdoor stadium in a cold city with an even worse quarterback. He's the most unlucky wide receiver in the league.
It's not a great move. Ronan, did you have anything you want to say about either the Colts or indeed what Buffalo have done?
No, just Philip Rivers, like, there have been comparisons drawn between him and Brady, especially in recent years as their decline seems to be mirroring one another. And Brady's big complaint was that he didn't have the personnel to throw to. Philip Rivers can't have had that complaint in the last few seasons, so it'll be interesting to see how he gets on with the Colts. I do wonder, Jacoby Brissett is at a loose end now. Will Bill Belichick pick up the phone and say, do you want to come back and do this thing? Or is Jared Stidham going to be the guy for the Patriots next season? It's still up in the air.
Yeah, I have a feeling that it's going to be Stidham because there's an ego involved in Belichick that's going to be, I can do this. Look what I can do with Jared Stidham. I don't need you, Tom Brady.
It feels like Andy Dalton's been used as the pawn. It's like, if I can bring Andy Dalton in and win a championship with Andy Dalton, I can do anything. And we always see on First Take and all these debate shows, Jared, that who gets more credit, Belichick or Brady. We might find out this year who is the more talented of that combo.
Yeah, Brady's a system quarterback is the dig that they always put to him. A reminder that American football brought to you on the Snap in association with the Aer Lingus College Football Classic, Navy versus Notre Dame at the Aviva on the 29th of August. You should get on to collegefootballireland.com. There's a couple of other things that we wanted to talk about. Calais Campbell was the other one. Is a 34-year-old Calais Campbell still very good, Cian?
I just don't want to brush past that Father Jack impression that was meant to be Bill Belichick there. I'm not sure where that was going. Calais Campbell is... So he's a superstar defensive lineman, been one of the best defensive linemen in the league for a long time. He's just older now, but he's older while also playing, I think, 770 snaps last year, 790, something like that. He was one of the highest playing, most active defensive linemen in the league. And the quality that he brings is that he can play on the inside, play on the outside. He's an individual pass rusher who's going to win over and over, which is what the Ravens don't have. They franchise tag Matt Judon, but he's not that caliber of player. They also added Michael Brock, who's more of a run stopper. So they've obviously identified the defensive line as a big issue for them. Calais Campbell is a great addition. They got him for dirt cheap. But on more of a macro level, when it comes to the Jaguars and trading players away, and the players coming off of the Jaguars roster, I think they're like a market inefficiency, or there's great value there, because those guys were all clearly miserable playing for Tom Coughlin. And while they're all individually still very good, there was an atmosphere there that probably dragged them down a little bit and got them to play to a different level. And the Jaguars are now rebuilding and giving these guys away for nothing. AJ Bouye, Calais Campbell, like Ramsey was obviously already gone. But the Campbell value and the Ravens is huge. He's an addition that only pushes them closer to the Super Bowl. They were already nearly at.
Yeah, all right. It's going to be an amazing AFC. Guys, thanks very much for being part of the Snap this morning at short notice. Obviously, it's been a tumultuous 24 hours in the NFL. We'll do this properly again on Friday when we've had time to consider all the other moves. And as I said, there's still some big moves to fall. Where will Cam Newton end up playing next year? So that is your lot from OTBAM this morning. We'll have another episode for you tomorrow morning. Off the Ball, back on your radios tonight from 7 o'clock. Padraig Harrington is going to join Joe Malloy, and obviously they'll be talking about the Ryder Cup and what's going to happen there. The US organisers were saying that they expect the Ryder Cup to go ahead as planned in September, which would be good news if they could see a way for that to happen. Get over and subscribe to the OTBAM podcast. It's fully time-stamped. It makes it very easy to find exactly what you want from this morning's show. Very thoughtful piece with Graham Hunter. We had Conan Byrne on talking about walking marathon today to try and raise funds for the Irish Cancer Society. We also had a good half an hour with Joe Brawley where he talked specifically about what's happening in the North and the role that the GAA has to play and has played already in getting social distancing to seep into the culture. When pubs are open, restaurants are open, and schools and colleges are still open as per the government directives. A reminder that that's what's happening on our island. We're with you every morning here on OTBAM from 7:30, Ireland's first and only sports breakfast show. We hope you enjoyed today. We hope that we've provided some bit of distraction from the rest of the news. Stay tuned to our social channels and we'll keep you up to date with all the rest of the cancellations and the repercussions from the cancellations over the coming days and weeks. And we're also going to be bringing you some new culture, talking Better Call Saul on the show, talking Dream Team and loads of other stuff. And there'll be a Dadcast today at some point too, if it kills us. We'll see you tomorrow. Best of luck.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.